of a difficult task.
To enter and for full terms, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/allinthemind. You have until 1 p.m. on Wednesday the 8th of January 2025 to enter. Can't wait to read what you have to say.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 19th of November. This is Today with Amol Rajan in London and Johnny Diamond in Wiltshire. The National Farmers Union has called the government's plans on inheritance tax a betrayal ahead of a day of protests at Westminster. I've been speaking to farmers here about Labour's plans to change how farms are passed from one generation to the next.
For this 300-acre farm, including a small house in the village, we would actually end up having to pay £500,000 tax. Sadly, you feel totally let down.
The other main headline this morning, world leaders at the G20 summit have called for peace in Ukraine days after the US gave Kyiv the go-ahead to use long-range missiles made in America against Russia. Also in today's programme, just how close are we to finding alien life on distant planets? We'll get an update as the SETI Institute, that search for extraterrestrial intelligence, turns 40.
Every time you look at the star, there is a planet, at least one, orbiting around it. And that changes completely the way we're perceiving ourselves and the way we're perceiving the universe around us.
And we go deep inside the drive to survive at Mercedes F1 racing team and beyond with former driver, now team principal, Toto Wolff. That's coming up just before 9 o'clock. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies meeting in Brazil have issued a statement calling for a comprehensive, just and durable peace in Ukraine. But the G20 communique gave no indication of how this could be achieved and failed to directly criticise Russia's invasion. The Chinese President Xi Jinping, in a separate statement, urged leaders to cool down the conflict. His comments come after President Biden authorised the use of long-range US missiles against targets in Russia. From Rio de Janeiro, here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Russia is making gains on the battlefield, Ukraine's on the back foot, and world leaders are losing patience. In a joint statement, the G20 complained about the human suffering of the war and its negative impact on global food and energy security. The leaders said they supported constructive initiatives leading to a durable peace. According to Chinese state media, President Xi urged leaders to cool the Ukraine crisis and seek a political solution. He was speaking after the US allowed Kyiv to use long-range missiles against targets in Russia. Sir Keir Starmer won't say if the UK will allow Ukraine to use British-built missiles in the same way, citing operational security. But the Prime Minister insists allies should double down on their support for the country.
The president of the National Farmers Union has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on some properties an extraordinary betrayal. Tom Bradshaw is leading a group of his members to Westminster today to lobby their MPs and urge the Chancellor to scrap the policy. A separate rally will take place near Downing Street later in the day. The government insists it's supporting farmers with more financial assistance and that relatively few will be affected by the tax changes. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Labour won some predominantly rural seats for the very first time at the general election, but now the NFU's president, Tom Bradshaw, is accusing the party of betrayal. He's expected to tell his members that he's not known a budget as bad for farming in his lifetime. His hope is that when MPs face the wrath of constituents, they'll then put pressure on the Chancellor to change course. Rachel Reeves has said she understands the strength of feeling, but under her plans, the wealthiest estates and the most valuable farms will pay their fair share to invest in the services on which rural communities rely.
Some of Britain's biggest retailers have warned that new costs being imposed on the industry next year will make job losses inevitable and higher prices a certainty. In a letter to the Chancellor, the British Retail Consortium says they could have to absorb an extra £7 billion of costs because of policies announced in the budget. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. The letter's been signed by senior figures from more than 70 retail businesses, including the bosses of Tesco, Superdry, The Perfume Shop and Wickes. It says tax increases announced in the budget, including changes to national insurance contributions and a higher minimum wage, will hurt retailers, potentially leading to higher prices and shop closures. It also suggests that proposed changes to business rates are being brought in too slowly and don't go far enough. The government insists difficult choices were needed to pay for improved public services and more funding for the NHS.
A court in Hong Kong has jailed 45 democracy activists. They'd been found guilty of subversion for organising a vote to choose opposition candidates for local elections. The United States has strongly condemned the sentencing. Our correspondent in Hong Kong, Danny Vincent, reports.
Many of the pro-democracy activists had been in detention for close to 4 years. Some members of the public camped outside the court for 3 days to get a seat. But when the sentence came down, it was swift. The longest sentence of 10 years was handed down to law professor Benny Tai, considered an organiser of the primary elections in 2020, which the authorities deemed to violate the national security law. Outside court, tensions were high. A large number of police watched on as family members of the convicted claimed their loved ones were the victims of political persecution.
Figures show that almost £2 million has been claimed as a result of the disorder across the UK in the summer sparked by the killing of three young girls in Southport. The Association of Police and Crime Commissioners says 88 separate claims have been registered under the Riot Compensation Act. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will set out plans today to overhaul policing, including establishing a unit dedicated to improving performance. She'll tell a conference of senior officers of the need to rebuild the public's trust and confidence in the work of police. More from our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
Policing has been hit by a number of scandals in recent years, and the Home Secretary wants her speech to open a new chapter. She says the dedicated unit she's creating will pull together national data to monitor police forces' performance. Separately, a new National Centre for Policing will employ specialists in areas such as forensics and IT to look at how forces could be more efficient. Yvette Cooper will also commit to restoring community patrols and investing more than £500 million of extra funding for policing next year.
The family of Harshita Brella, who was found dead in the boot of a car in East London last week, say they're heartbroken about her death. In an interview with the BBC in India, Ms. Brella's parents and sister said they now wanted justice. Detectives in the UK believe her husband, Pankaj Lamba, murdered the 24-year-old and fled the country. British Airways flights across the world have faced delays after a technical fault grounded its planes. Passengers in the UK and in cities such as Hamburg and Naples began reporting problems at around 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. In a statement, BA said the issue had been resolved and that flights were operating as normal.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It is 7 minutes past six and time to say good morning to Helen Willetts, who's got the weather for us. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Amal. Hello, good morning. Snow has been falling through the night, so it's our first significant wintry spell of the autumn. And we've had a few centimetres, actually, and they're falling and settling across parts of northern England, the Midlands and North Wales. So let's start with England and Wales, where actually it's clearing away that mixture of wintry weather from the north of England. So it's icy here and frosty. Across the Midlands, much of Wales, across to East Anglia and Lincolnshire, we've got that wintry mix and snow is falling, as I mentioned, hopefully not sticking on some of the faster routes, but nevertheless, with temperatures close to freezing, it's going to be icy anyway. And further south, well, temperatures about 10 or 12 degrees here and heavy rain. But the whole mix is just going to push its way southwards through the day, clearing from the north to allow a more straightforward story, really, if you like, of sunny spells and a scattering of showers, mostly near the east coast. But as it does push southwards, despite weakening, there could be a few wintry flurries within it, even further south, as temperatures are likely to drop through the afternoon to between 2 and 7 for most of us. It's our coldest day of the autumn so far. For Northern Ireland, we are also seeing that wintry mix starting to clear away, but it's icy this morning. Good spells of sunshine, just isolated showers through the day, but temperatures barely 2 or 3 degrees Celsius, I think, is the high. And for Scotland, it's a hard frost that we wake to this morning, so icy patches are around where we've had the showers, and those showers will continue to fall in the northern and western Isles, the northern mainland as well, and they could certainly fall as snow. That's it for now.
Thanks very much, Helen. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's take a look at the morning papers and what's on the news websites. The Daily Telegraph says the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told farmers she won't be reversing plans announced in the budget to bring in inheritance tax on farms worth more than £1 million. In a statement, Mr. Reeves says the reforms are necessary to, in her words, ensure that wealthier estates and the most valuable farms pay their fair share to invest in our schools and health services. But the paper notes that a first Labour peer has now criticised the government over the plans. Baroness Malyneux said Labour had become an urban party divorced from much of the rural community. The Sun says Jeremy Clarkson, who is recovering from a heart operation, will join up to 20,000 farmers marching in Westminster in a few hours' time in protest at what the paper calls the hated tractor tax.
The Guardian, Telegraph and The Times all highlight Sir Keir Starmer's comments about Ukraine after President Biden's decision to allow Kyiv to use long-range US missiles to strike deep into Russia. All three papers suggest the move may be too little too late to alter the course of the war. The Daily Mirror notes that Britain stands shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine, but it also suggests that the UK shouldn't underestimate the possible consequences of following Washington and allowing Ukraine to use its long-range weapons on Russia too. And I should just say that we'll have more on that specific issue and story at 10 to 8.
The Times reports that the British Retail Consortium letter warning of job losses because of the government's tax plans is the first time many of the companies have gone public with their concerns. It says that the Treasury tried to discourage several of the businesses from signing the letter, though it gives no further detail.
According to the Daily Telegraph, the business secretary has suggested that if Donald Trump were to spark a trade war with China, Britain would be likely to side with the European Union rather than the US. There are fears that Mr. Trump could ask US trading partners such as the UK to follow his reported plans to slap tariffs on Chinese imports, which could put Britain at odds with Brussels. Jonathan Reynolds, the business secretary, said that because the UK's bilateral trade with the EU outweighed that with the US, London would have to consider the consequences of an adverse relationship with Europe.
The Times, the Daily Mail both have more on, in their words, the IT meltdown at British Airways. The Mail calls it chaos and says dozens of flights were disrupted by the major technological glitch, leaving thousands of passengers standing in the cold waiting to board flights. The Times says a huge knock-on effect is expected.
According to the Financial Times, some of China's biggest tech groups in Silicon Valley are trying to poach US talent to help them develop artificial intelligence. It says Alibaba, ByteDance and Muitan are all trying to expand operations despite Washington's efforts to curb Beijing's AI work.
It is 12 minutes past six. If you were expecting to wake up to a thick blanket of snow, I'm sorry to disappoint. That cold snap the Met Office promised is not quite with us. Some parts of the country got a bit of a dusting and some pretty nippy weather is on the way for most of us. Ollie Constable is our correspondent following the wind and snow and is on the border between South Yorkshire and Derbyshire.
This is our first taste of winter, really, isn't it? I am in Owler Bar, which is high above the city of Sheffield, right on the edge of the Peak District. In fact, I'm standing next to a big sign, a big gritstone that says Peak District National Park. It's here where we were told that we're going to be getting the most of the snow, up to 200 millimetres of the white stuff falling here. Our drive up here was quite treacherous as well, because even on low ground in parts of Derbyshire and South Yorkshire, there's seen a large amount of snow, up to 100 millimetres falling there. Those yellow weather warnings are in place for Northern Ireland, Northern Scotland, Northern Wales and large parts of Northern England and the Midlands until about 11 o'clock this morning. And we can see as well the amount of disruption that this kind of snow has been causing. While we've been here, we've seen lots of snow ploughs and gritters going past us trying to keep people on the move, but we do know that many roads are, especially those that are untreated, are quite treacherous indeed. Getting off the road onto a main road for a lot of people today will be the main issue.
And if people across the country were expecting freezing temperatures this morning and they haven't got them quite yet, well, they should hang on because they are about to come, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I'm standing, like I say, in the edge of the Peak District. It is absolutely freezing here. Lows of -3 for much of this area. We're going to be seeing that throughout today as well. That cold weather not going anywhere. You might not be getting the snow that we're seeing in certain parts of the country, but certainly that coldness, that Arctic blast that we've been feeling, you are going to be feeling lots of that. I was at a gritting depot yesterday in Leeds that was preparing for those freezing temperatures. They've had teams out throughout the night, and so they will be having teams throughout the day as well, because that weather is not going to be getting warmer even when the sun comes up. It's still going to be, for much of the country, freezing temperatures.
Ollie Constable, thank you very much indeed.
It's 14 minutes past six. Extraordinary events, a turn of events indeed, weather in Delhi, where the smog in Delhi, the Indian capital, has surged to 60 times, that's 6-0, 60 times the World Health Organization's recommended daily maximum. India's Supreme Court, meanwhile, has criticised the authorities in Delhi for the delay in enforcing restrictions to limit that worsening air pollution. Since Monday, all diesel trucks exposed, except those carrying essential items, have been banned from entering the city. Most school classes have been moved online. Arunadoy Mukherjee is our correspondent in Delhi and joins us now. Arunadoy, good morning from London. Just tell us, why is the smog so particularly bad in Delhi right now?
Well, good morning from a very, very smoggy Delhi. Well, it's honestly an annual problem, and it's getting worse by the year. Every year we think this is the worst, but it seems to surprise us every year. Now, there are a couple of reasons why this happens. It's primarily because of the onset of winter, and that's when it gets really bad, because temperatures dip. And due to lower wind speeds, the smoke and dust of the previous months remain suspended in the air. The other big factor is the crop harvest season. Now, the crop stubble burning in the northern parts of India adds to the toxic air as well. That's a convenient and a very affordable way for farmers to dispose of their crop residue. There's rapid industrialization and construction, which make matters worse. And as you pointed out in your introduction, you know, there have been some observations made by the Supreme Court. But the problem is, when you look at the politics of it all, Delhi is governed by a different political party, and federally, India is governed by a different political party. So there's always a blame game. The Delhi government blames the central government for not formulating enough policies to tackle the problem. And the federal government says this is something that the Delhi government needs to figure out and get under control.
So amid that political dispute, I mean, it seems such a shame that politics should get in the way, as it so often does. But what can be done to reduce the smog? Is it a case of waiting for the winds to pick up, as you say, and the rain to come?
Honestly, that's about it. You're held hostage to that kind of a situation. You're hoping every morning when we wake up that there's going to be a little bit of wind, there might be a little bit of rain, but unfortunately, weather experts have said that the situation might just get worse over the next few days before it actually gets better. Having said all of this, there is a little improvement today, and you know, we're all celebrating marginal improvements given how bad the situation is. We can see the sun shining a little bit, something that's been elusive over the past few days, but even as I look out of the window right now, there's a thick, visible white blanket which drapes the buildings in front. It adds to the problems when you walk out. I can tell you, as a person living in Delhi, you have labored breathing, your eyes burn, you feel very, very unwell, and that's something doctors are also saying, that they're receiving many complaints of people coming in with respiratory problems.
Arunadoy Mukherjee in Delhi, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. We'll return to this story at about half past 8.
We are moments away from 18 minutes past 6. The biggest retailers in the UK are warning that job losses, price rises and shop closures are inevitable on the back of government policy changes. Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Johnny. Yeah, the bosses of 79 of the biggest names in retail, Tesco, Amazon, Greggs and Next, amongst plenty of other familiar names, have said those employers' national insurance increases, added to those other changes like minimum wage increases, a new tax on packaging coming in as well, would increase costs for the industry by £7 billion a year. Helen Dickinson is the chief executive of the British Retail Consortium, who organised the letter.
I guess the fact that so many businesses signed the letter really highlights the strength of feeling. And it was a consequence, really, of all of those businesses and I guess everybody in retail really working through the consequences of the the not just the costs in the budget, but everything else all happening at the same time.
In an hour's time, I'm going to be talking to the boss of Accessorize and Monsoon about the specifics for their business. I've got Freddie Cahoon with me now, who's the investment director at JM Finn. Morning, Freddie.
Morning, Sean.
Do you necessarily see this playing out across the world of retail the way those businesses are saying to the government in a letter today, Will?
Yeah, I mean, the point is that all these policy changes are coming at the same time. It's not just one change. It's about four policy changes coming in April next year. As you said, the packaging levy, NI changes, national living wage going up, and the uplift of business rates. And, you know, we've been meeting small and medium-sized businesses, both in the retail sector, but also the hospitality sector, the recruitment centre. And they're all struggling. They're all finding the same issues coming straight down the line, head on to them, particularly after a really difficult couple of years as well, which, you know, started off with COVID and then the energy crisis, etc. So I think they are certainly looking at the amount of people that they will continue to employ. They'll also be looking at the salaries that they're going to be paying people and, you know, at the risk of losing very talented people from their companies.
Is it changing the investment prospects for the industry when the likes of JM Finn speak to those businesses and you then get such a good idea of what their plans are going to be over the next year or so?
Yeah, well, the focus is always on, you know, controlling costs, but also trying to maximise your revenues and on maintaining your margins. And this will certainly put pressure on margins.
Wanted to ask you about a few other stories knocking around this morning, Freddie. Tesla. We saw shares rise in Tesla by more than 5% yesterday. But there seems to be a bit of conflicting news out of whether it's Donald Trump and his team about what exactly his plan might be for electric vehicles. Is new regulation going to be a good thing for Tesla?
Well, possibly it could be. I mean, earlier this week, there was news that to say that the new administration would cut the credits available for purchasing electric vehicles. And now the news last night, which pushed the shares up, is to say that they're looking at producing a new federal framework that will be for autonomous vehicles. And that's going to be quite interesting, particularly for Tesla, because the current rules make it very difficult to deploy vehicles without steering wheels or pedals like the Tesla Cybertruck. And so there could well be a good benefit here for Tesla if this comes to pass.
Latest developments in the Thames Water saga, Freddie, is that creditors of Thames Water seem to have approved this plan for the utility company to use about £400 million from its reserve accounts to keep it going until February. Is this any kind of reassurance for the long-term prospects of the business?
Not really. I mean, this is really sort of emergency measures here, and it's quite rare for this to happen. So £400 million has been released, but that's only going to be giving them a lifeline until February 2025. And it highlights the real problem here that was highlighted on Sue Gray's list when Labour came in as one of the top priorities for trying to sort out the future of Thames Water. So we'll have to wait and see what happens in February.
Freddie, thank you. Good to talk to you this morning. Freddie Cahoon there from JM Finn. In the commodity markets, the price of gold took a bit of a jump yesterday to over $2,600 an ounce. There's been some predictions knocking around. It might reach $3,000 by the end of next year, particularly from the analysts at Goldman Sachs. Anika Gupta keeps a close eye on this as Director of Macroeconomic Research at WisdomTree. Morning, Anika.
Morning.
What was the jump yesterday all about?
Well, you know, we saw oil prices pull back a little, and we even saw yields in the U.S. come down, and that provided an important tailwind for gold, which has been under pressure since the election results in the U.S. Essentially, with Trump being reelected, we're likely to see much higher inflation in the U.S. going forward. That's been pressuring yields, U.S. yields on the upside. And that also poses a risk for gold that is a non-yielding asset. So
when you say non-yielding assets, if you own some, you're not getting some cash out of it every single year.
Exactly. And so gold prices tend to do a lot better when they don't have the pressure of higher yields. And that's been, you know, predominantly the story for most of 2024. But now that there's this renewed risk that, we'll have much stronger U.S. economic data, higher U.S. yields, higher inflation, expectations for those rate cuts by the Federal Reserve have begun to come down.
When you talk, Inigo, about higher yields, what do you mean by that?
So I mean higher treasury yields, so the higher rates that are being paid on the bonds in the US.
It's a higher cost of borrowing effectively for the US government.
Absolutely.
And that can then filter through to higher interest rates, I guess, for American households and ripple effect across the world. What is the role of gold these days, Anika? I just want to, once upon a time, we wouldn't have talked about the likes of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. We've been used to very low interest rates for a very long time until recent years. Has the purpose of gold changed?
Not at all. Gold has always been viewed as a safe haven asset. Investors even use gold as a hedge against inflation. Now, we've seen some renewed interest from central banks. Since the Russia-Ukraine war, we've seen central bank demand, provide this structural bid to the gold market. Essentially, we've been seeing central banks stock up on their gold purchases. Even if you look at the recent report by the World Gold Council, the expectation for central banks going forward is that they intend to increase their purchases of gold. So that remains a very important tailwind over the long term.
Right.
Given the background of geopolitical risks still remaining quite high, that gold as a store of value and a safe haven hedge, really puts its demand up in these current times.
Anika, thank you. Anika Gupta there from WisdomTree, talking of geopolitical risks. Sir Keir Starmer becoming the first UK Prime Minister yesterday to meet with President Xi Jinping of China since 2018. Downing Street saying the UK will be a predictable and pragmatic partner to China. But what does that mean for trade? It's our fifth biggest trading partner, nearly £90 billion of trading goods and services in the 12 months to June. Nick Glynn is chief executive of the Buy It Direct Group, owns a number of online retailers, including Appliances Direct and Better Bathrooms. Morning, Nick.
Morning. Hi.
How does your business contribute to that £90 billion of trading goods and services?
Yeah, sure. We're massively dependent on imports from China. So words like pragmatism and consistency are really welcome. We import around 3,100 containers a year from throughout the world, of which 2,900 are coming from China. So 85 million of our 90 million imports are dependent on trade with China.
What does the difference being predictable and pragmatic mean? Almost on the margins for the stuff that you're importing.
Yeah, sure. So there's two elements to the relationship with China that have always brought concern to us from a business perspective. Is firstly, any risk of tariffs increasing. So most products are coming over at zero tariffs, and that's partly because we have no other choice about where to source from other than China. There's no local sourcing for TVs or other of the products that we import. And the second thing is the political risk that there would be some form of confrontation, particularly around Taiwan, which would massively disrupt our supply chain.
Are we too hooked on imports from China?
Absolutely. We're too hooked on China. We're utterly dependent on China. It's not a healthy thing, but we haven't got any choice. The supply chain is so sophisticated over there. So taking the example of TVs, there'll be 200, 300 component manufacturers within a few miles of the main TV manufacturer, which can't be replicated. You can't wish into existence a new supply chain.
Is there any alternative that we should be working towards? We talk about security in certain areas, whether it's building things ourselves or having different supply chains. How do you try and deal with that?
Sure. I mean, after COVID, during the freight crisis, we frantically looked to other countries to source products. We went to Turkey, we looked at India, we looked at Vietnam. And unfortunately, most of the products don't exist out there. Or when they do, for example, in Turkey, they do make some TVs, but all the components are imported from China. So either way, there's an absolute dependency on manufacturing over there. There is no alternative. And to bring, as I said before, to will one into existence is extremely expensive and time consuming.
And, on that balance of trade with China, do you feel like we have any weight in the say of all this? We talk about being a predictable and pragmatic partner. I mean, is China remotely reliant upon your business?
Very little. I mean, my impression is they're disinterested in the UK, only seeing us as a customer. I don't think we've got a huge amount to offer back.
And for you, Nick, your prospects now, you know, the way our dynamic might change with Donald Trump in the United States, Europe, China, is this changing things?
Yeah, sure. I suppose it gives an opportunity to Britain. If China was a little bit worried that trade would be affected with because of tariffs into the US, maybe there's a bit more opportunity. Their industrial policy depends so much on foreign trade still. So if they see Britain and Europe as an alternative, then that can only be good for us.
Nick, thanks very much. Nick Glynn, Chief Executive of that Buy It Direct group. I will be back after 7, chatting to the boss of Accessorize and Monsoon about those concerns, the repercussions that are being laid out by so many retail bosses this morning of the tax increases and the rest from Rachel Reeves' budget.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. And I know, Sean, you're going to be getting into the implications for farmers, particularly tenant farmers and their businesses in the coming weeks as the fallout from those budget changes continues. Johnny Diamond is presenting this programme for us from a farm in Wiltshire this morning. More from Johnny after we've heard the news. But before that, here's Carthy with the sport. Morning, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Scotland avoided relegation and instead will have a Nations League playoff in March to decide their status in the competition after a 2-1 win over Poland. Thanks to a stoppage time header from the Scotland captain Andy Robertson. Head coach Steve Clark feels they have been building as a squad to this point.
We started with 3 defeats, 3 narrow defeats with good performances. The players didn't lose belief. I didn't lose belief in the players. And they end up taking 7 points for the last 3 games. The more you play at this level, the more you learn how to win the games. And that's what we've proved.
Northern Ireland were 2-0 ahead but drew 2-2 with Luxembourg. That is, however, enough for Northern Ireland to be promoted to League B in the Nations League. Wales host Iceland tonight and need to win that match to win the group and secure their return to the top tier of the Nations League, but they also need other results to go their way. The Tottenham midfielder Rodrigo Bentancur has been given a 7-match domestic ban and a £100,000 fine by the FA for using a racial slur about teammates Son Heung-min. Bentancur was also charged by the FA in September after comments made while appearing on TV in his home country of Uruguay in the summer. The 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal will retire from tennis after representing Spain in the men's team event, the Davis Cup, this week in Malaga. Spain play the Netherlands in the quarterfinals today, with Nadal determined to remain competitive at the age of 38.
I'm not here for retiring. I'm here to try to help the team. Then it's, of course, going to be my last week on the professional tour, but at the end, we are here in a team's competition.
In the women's team event, the Billie Jean King Cup, the British number one Katie Bolter is confident of their potential to win ahead of Britain's semi-final against Slovakia today.
We take nothing for granted at any point. They're a very strong team. I personally believe that they should be there in the semi-finals. They're all great players and we've got a big task ahead of us. We're going to have to play some of our best tennis.
Great Britain are attempting to reach the final for the first time since 1981. And you can watch that BJK Cup semi-final on the BBC iPlayer and app from 11 o'clock this morning.
Thanks, Carthy. This evening, Radio 4's favourite agony aunts are back.
Hello, this is Tara Flynn.
And this is Marion Keyes.
And we'd like to remind you that our show for BBC Radio 4, Now You're Asking, is back for a new series.
I'd love your advice. I work quite successfully as a professional photographer. I've recently received a message from a girl who bullied me in school. She wants me to shoot her wedding next summer.
Each week we take real listeners' questions and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help, but also hopefully entertain.
Never wrestle with a pig because you'll both get covered in mud and the pig will enjoy it.
Now You're Asking with Marion Keyes and Tara Flynn, tonight at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Johnny Diamond in Wiltshire and Amol Rajan in London. Here's a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
World leaders at the G20 summit in Brazil have agreed a joint statement calling for a comprehensive, just and durable peace in Ukraine. It comes after President Biden gave Kyiv permission to use long-range US missiles on targets deep inside Russia. Sir Keir Starmer won't say if the UK will allow Ukraine to use British-built missiles in the same way, but he insists allies should double down on their support for the country. The head of the National Farmers Union has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on some farms an extraordinary betrayal. Tom Bradshaw is leading a group of his members to Westminster today to urge the government to scrap the policy. A separate rally will take place near Downing Street later in the day. The government says relatively few farmers will be affected by the tax changes, which apply to properties worth more than £1 million. Some of Britain's biggest retailers have warned that new costs being imposed on the industry will make higher prices and job losses inevitable. In a letter to the Chancellor, the British Retail Consortium said they could have to absorb an extra £7 billion of cost next year because of policies announced in the budget. Tesco, Superdry, the perfume shop Greggs and dozens of other chains are urging the Treasury to reconsider the measures. A Hong Kong court has sentenced 45 democracy activists to jail. It's the territory's biggest national security trial since China clamped down on dissent. They've been found guilty of subversion after organising a vote to choose candidates for elections. Several Western countries have condemned the sentencings. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will set out plans today to overhaul policing, including establishing a unit dedicated to improving performance. She'll tell a conference of senior officers of the need to rebuild the public's trust and confidence in the work of the force. British Airways flights across the world faced delays yesterday after a technical fault grounded its planes. Passengers in the UK and in cities such as Hamburg and Naples began reporting problems at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. BA says the issues has now been resolved and flights are operating as normal.
Thanks very much, Lisa. It is 25 minutes to seven. Changes to inheritance tax do not normally spark a national conversation, a mass lobby and a march through London, but that's what changes to agricultural property relief in last month's budget have done. I'm broadcasting today from a farm in Wiltshire. We'll be hearing from farmers about their concerns later in the programme. First, let's talk to our chief political correspondent, Henry Zerfman. Henry, good morning. Comparisons have been drawn to George Osborne's rather ill-fated pasty tax, introduced by him, eventually withdrawn under pressure. Is there any sign of shifting like that from the government?
No, I don't think there is. The government has two perspectives on this. One is that they believe that as a matter of fairness, it is right that agricultural property pays some inheritance tax. But the other is this disagreement fundamentally between the government and the farmers, or at least organised farming, on how many people, how many farms would be affected by this change when it takes effect in April 2026. So the Treasury claims that it would affect about a quarter of farms. The NFU claims it would affect about two-thirds of farms. That's quite a profound difference, but it helps to explain why there is such a difference of opinion between the two sides on this issue more generally.
And any rumblings of discontent on the Labour benches? I mean, any sense that for an estimated, what, £200 million gain for the Treasury, the pain is out of proportion?
Well, the important thing to say is that this does affect Labour MPs, and that might sound a banal and obvious point, but it is worth noting that Labour have loads more rural MPs than they had before the general election as a consequence of their success. I'm told a group of MPs calling themselves the Rural PLP, i.e. Parliamentary Labour Party, are starting to meet regularly, and there's 70 of them. And speaking to one of them yesterday, who represents a seat that's never been Labour before, that is incredibly rural, they said, yes, there is significant anger among the farmers in their constituency, but they say it hasn't spread more generally to the rest of that rural constituency, and they hope it stays that way.
Henry Zerfman, Chief Political Correspondent, thank you very much. Let's talk about the numbers behind all of this, because, as we said, the estimates of how many farms, farmers and estates might be affected vary wildly. The government says around 500 estates a year will be caught up in it once the agricultural property relief is levied at 20% on estates worth more than £1 million. Top-end estimates the other way suggest that 70,000 farms are worth more than £1 million. Of course, that does not compare like with like, estates and farms, as Ben Chu, policy and analysis correspondent from BBC Verify, can tell us. Ben, can you just talk us first of all through that disparity? 500 a year, says the government. Tens of thousands, say the farmers.
Yeah, absolutely, Johnny. There's a lot of claims being thrown around. So let's talk through it. I think it's best to start with the fact that there is roughly around 210,000 farms in the UK, And some farming groups, as you say, have been saying that around 70,000 of those will be affected. So that's around a third, which they say are worth over £1 million and will therefore be hit. But the National Farmers Union is also pointing to Environment Department figures, which seem to suggest up to two-thirds of farms in England are potentially worth over £1 million. So from farmers, between a third and two-thirds of farms, they say, are going to be impacted. Meanwhile, as you've been hearing, the government says no more than 27% of farming estates will be affected in any given year, and probably less. So who's right? Well, we at Verify think that the 70,000 figure is an overestimate, because various exemptions will come into play, like the allowance for people to pass on their main family home free of inheritance tax, and the ability of people to transfer allowances between married couples. So just because a farm is worth more than £1 million plus on paper doesn't mean it would be liable necessarily to pay inheritance tax. And we think that those Environment Department figures on farms in England have been misinterpreted, because they're based on a survey which excludes a lot of smaller farms. So bottom line is, we think the true share of farms affected will probably be much closer to the Treasury's estimates, which are based on actual claims in past years for relief from inheritance tax. All that said, it is true that many farmers will be asset rich and cash poor, because official figures show they only have a 0.5% average return on their capital, basically their profit margin each year. And that is not high relative to most other firms.
Ben Chu from BBC Verify, thank you.
Plenty more on that issue throughout the programme, including 10 past 8. But now, 20 to 7, let's turn to Ukraine, because Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the US envoy to the UN in New York, said yesterday that America would support something akin to a surge by Ukraine against Russia after finally agreeing to President Zelensky's request that US-made so-called ATACMS long-range missiles could be fired by Ukraine deep into Russia. And David Willis, our North America correspondent, told me a little bit more about what Linda Thomas-Greenfield announced yesterday when I spoke to him a short time ago.
Well, hard on the heels of the Biden administration's decision to allow the use of these controversial long-range US-made missiles against targets deep in Russia, has come word, Amal, that the White House is planning additional support for Ukraine. The US ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said that the US would be announcing what she called additional security measures in the coming days. Now, she didn't specify what those might be, but she acknowledged that in the few weeks that remain of his administration, President Biden is committed to a surge of assistance for Ukraine, including artillery, air defense systems, armored vehicles, and so on. All part of an effort by the outgoing administration, it would seem, to leave Ukraine in the strongest position possible on the battlefield before Donald Trump takes charge in 2 months' time. And he's vowed to bring the conflict, of course, to a swift end. The hope is that if Ukraine can hold on to the territory from Russia that it has captured in the Kursk region to the east, then that would buy it some leverage in any ceasefire talks that could lie ahead.
And why has Biden changed his mind, David? Because, of course, for a long time, Zelensky asked for this help and Biden said no.
That's right. And he's been extremely reluctant, has President Biden, to authorize the use of these TACM long-range missiles, really for fear of antagonizing Vladimir Putin and drawing fellow NATO members into this conflict. And he's ignored repeated pleas, as you mentioned, from President Zelensky. But one key development in the last few weeks is thought to have changed his mind. That's the deployment of more than 10,000 North Korean special forces to fight alongside Russian troops on the battlefield. That's seen by the White House as a clear escalation of the conflict and therefore a justification for this change in policy. Now, today, Linda Thomas-Greenfield told the Security Council that sending North Korean soldiers to the front lines was a sign of desperation on Russia's part and one that violated various Security Council resolutions. She said that not in over 100 years has Russia welcomed foreign troops onto its soil.
David Willis, always good to talk to you. Thanks, David.
It is 17 minutes to 7.
Yeah, and just before you take us to yesterday in Parliament, Johnny, I'll give you listeners a flavour of what's in some of the papers. That story about the UK's response to this US change of policy in terms of long-range missiles in Ukraine is on many front pages. So The Guardian, UK expected to follow US in letting Kyiv use missiles to attack Russia. It's a sidebar story on the front of the Telegraph. Storm Shadows ready for use in Russia after US green light. The Times and The Eye are more kind of on the Putin response. So Kremlin threatens palpable response to Ukraine missiles is the Times headline at the top. The Eye says Putin threatens to strike back if UK and US arms are used in Russia. The story that Sean Farrington was talking about in our business news at 6:15, that's on the front, the bottom half of the front of the FT. Retailers warn Reeves of £7 billion burden as alarm mounts over budget changes. That's also on the front of the Times. I'll tell you another story that actually we should really turn our own minds to, and I think I'll have a word about how we do this, because it's very interesting. Bottom of the Guardian, more than one in three children in poverty, more than one in three children and a quarter of adults are in poverty in the UK after deprivation levels have risen to their highest in the 21st century. That's according to a report from the Social Metrics Commission, which uses measures recently adopted by the government to say there's been a very sharp rise, 2 million more people in hardship since the cost of living crisis.
Thanks, Amol. It's just coming up to 6:45. The government has outlined plans to stop companies that run England's children's homes from making excessive profits. The proposal was set out yesterday in Parliament in what the Education Secretary called the biggest reform in a generation. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
The Labour MP for Hartlepool, Jonathan Brash, laid out the hard maths facing many English councils.
With over 300 children in Hartlepool in social care, the council is being slowly bankrupted. The top four private providers, on average, are charging £12,000 per child per week. That's £624,000 a year per child.
And those enormous bills were just one of the problems the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, was hoping to tackle. In a statement to MPs, she explained that she wanted to shift the emphasis in children's care to early intervention, helping to keep youngsters with their families, and where that wasn't possible, moving them to kinship or foster care. But she accepted some would need care homes, and so she was taking action to stop the firms that run them from making excess profits, with the ultimate sanction of a legal limit on how much they could make.
If companies continue to make extreme profits at the cost of vulnerable children, I will go further and harder. We will introduce new powers that allow government to directly cap the level of profit from children's social care placements. At their best, private providers can help improve the lives of vulnerable children. But where the focus drifts towards exploitation in the pursuit of profit, be in no doubt, I will act.
The Conservative Shadow Education Secretary, Laura Trott, reckoned the problem was there just weren't enough places for looked-after children, with demand outstripping supply. And she feared a profit cap could make that worse.
So while I absolutely share the Secretary of State's desire to ensure we're getting best value for the taxpayer in this sector, I would argue that the capacity issue is what we need to solve first. Otherwise, she risks, ironically, driving up prices and exacerbating the shortage of places.
But an exasperated Bridget Phillipson insisted her government had done more in 4 months for children's social care than the Conservatives had in 14 years.
And the Right Honourable Lady has the temerity to stand there and carp about changes that we are bringing in for some of the most vulnerable children in our country.
The only backbench Conservative to speak was Graham Stewart, who thought the Education Secretary could have been more conciliatory.
I did regret the Secretary of State's tone, and I hope on issues such as this over time she may learn not to adopt it. As her shadow said, there is a capacity crisis now, and as she said, we need greater early intervention now.
Bridget Phillipson said she wasn't quite sure where to begin with what she called Graham Stewart's extraordinary remarks about her tone. And she went on to tell him that she was determined to make sure the resources were in place to support vulnerable children. There was backing for the government from the Liberal Democrats' Muneera Wilson.
Tackling profiteering will not just help to address the financial crisis facing councils, but to deliver better outcomes for our most vulnerable children and young people. children for whom we all bear huge responsibility in this place. And it's simply unacceptable that they've become a cash cow for private equity companies, raking in profits of 28% or more.
The Green Party's Ellie Chowns quoted a report on children's social care published in 2022.
Which stated that we need a revolution in family help, and specifically a $2.6 billion temporary injection of financial support to make that shift to prevention. Can she make that commitment?
The minister didn't make an explicit promise on that, but she said the government was determined to refocus the system, to give more support for kinship and foster families, and to move away from crisis intervention. While the Education Secretary was making changes, a Labour MP, Emma Lewell Buck, wanted her to sweep away one more thing.
Children in care have died in unregulated accommodation. But this did not stop the last Conservative government in introducing cruel legislation to make it permissible for councils to place children in care aged 16 and above into such accommodation. Tents, caravans, B&Bs, HMOs, surrounded by adult strangers and with no continuing care at all.
She wanted that law overturned. Bridget Phillipson said there were an increasing number of children in unsafe or unregistered placements, and she'd take action to, as she put it, hit providers where it hurts, as the current threat of prosecution clearly wasn't working.
That was Alicia McCarthy. You can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio. It's just about 11 minutes to 7. Let's turn to the railways, because later today the House of Commons will vote on a bill called the Passenger Railway Services (brackets Public Ownership) Bill. And the brackets are doing a lot of work there, because this is about moving Britain's railways back into public ownership, a Labour manifesto commitment. What will that mean for you as a commuter? Well, Andy Bagnall is Chief Executive of Rail Partners, who represent the parent companies for train and freight operators, and has come in to see us in the studio. Andy, good morning.
Morning.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in. So in the short term, if this bill does pass, how is it going to change life for our commuting listeners?
Well, look, train companies absolutely agree that there needs to be change. Like the government, we want a better railway for the people who use it. That's passengers, but also freight customers and the people who pay for it. That's all of us as taxpayers. We do still believe, and we've made this point consistently, that nationalisation is the wrong answer. It's a political rather than a practical solution. And it won't fix the things that passengers really care about. Affordability, ticket prices, punctuality and reliability. We absolutely do recognise the government has a mandate to make this change, take this bill through Parliament. It won a very large sort of victory at the election. So the course is set as the bill that's in the Commons today reaches its final stages sort of this week or next. So this is something of a watershed. It marks the moment that the government's taking responsibility, and now it's going to have to work out how it will deliver those things that passengers want. And most of that won't happen until the second bill that the government is saying it will introduce next year.
And why do you say that it won't deliver on the intention, which is cheaper, faster, cleaner, more punctual trains?
Well, look, to solve some of the challenges that we're facing on the railway, we have to correctly diagnose what the causes are of those challenges, and particularly the sort of the impact of the pandemic. And blaming train companies exclusively for the challenges that the railway's facing doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. We've got a mixed market at the moment. There are a number of public operators, a number of private operators. About 4 in 10 of the train miles that are run are actually being run by public operators. Northern, LNER, ScotRail, Transport for Wales, and so on. And those public operators are facing exactly the same challenges as private train companies. If you look at the figures from the regulator around reliability, for the figures for the last full year, of the 8 least reliable train operators, 4 were public, 4 were private. Similarly, Network Rail, that's the infrastructure manager. So they run the tracks, the you know, the tunnels, the bridges and
signals,
so on.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. 6 out of 10 of the delay minutes, and delay minutes are how we count the impact of delays on the railway. 6 out of 10 of the delay minutes are the responsibility of the infrastructure manager. And that has been in the public sector for nearly 20 years. What I'm trying to describe, I'm not denigrating Network Rail or public operators, but I'm suggesting that simply changing who runs the trains, which is all this bill does, it sort of makes it illegal for private sector operators to be contracted to run trains. Simply changing who runs the trains isn't going to solve those challenges of reliability or cost.
It's very interesting what you're saying. It's it's interesting what you say about the mixed market we've got. But what has gone wrong, though, Andy? Because a lot of people in this country look at, for instance, Europe, and they think that, you know, the trains there are cheap, punctual, fast and clean and nice to travel. And they feel that actually in this country they're not so much. So what do you think is going wrong that we can address?
Well, we've consistently advocated a best of both worlds approach. So a guiding mind, a new public body that would bring track and train together and join up the railway, but then harnessing train companies to do the bit that they can do better than the public sector can do on its own. That's have commercial focus, look outwards to the passenger. And interestingly, that's exactly the model that's increasingly being adopted across Europe.
Everyone's coming to us to learn from us rather than the other way around.
They, believe it or not, that's it. That's exactly right. That actually they're looking at the successes of the British model, and while the franchising system wasn't perfect, what it did see was a doubling of passenger numbers, services increased by a third. We run a very busy railway, and actually European countries are looking how you can do that, how you can get the best of both public and private sectors to deliver for passengers.
We'll try and have a look at Europe as well to make the most of it, what we can learn from there. Andy Bagnall, Chief Executive of Rail Partners, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It's 6 minutes to seven. Welcome back to Wiltshire, where we await the dawn on the farm that we're broadcasting from. It is pitch black outside, no street lights here. We're on a farm because 2,000 farmers are expected to attend a National Farmers Union organised mass lobby of Parliament today. More are expected to march through London. Changes into agricultural property relief announced in last month's budget have upset an awful lot of farmers. Until the budget, agricultural land had 100% relief from inheritance tax. Rachel Reeves scrapped that relief, and from 2026, those inheriting farmland and machinery will pay 20% tax on estates worth over £1 million. Various exemptions can take that threshold as high as £3 million. Those inheriting will have 10 years to pay. I should say, inheritance tax for most people, should they pay it, and most don't, is generally levied at 40%. Victoria Atkins is Shadow Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and she's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why should agricultural assets be treated differently from, say, cash in the bank or stocks and shares?
If we care about our countryside, if we want to hand on a countryside and an environment that is better for our children than that which we inherited, then we have to recognise that farming needs support, because as any farmer will tell you, farmers can be asset rich but cash poor. I've been meeting farmers over the last couple of weeks since this budget of broken promises. And by the way, it's not just the inheritance tax through which the Labour government is attacking family farming. There are two other broken promises as well, including delinking of the payments made to farmers, which will see some tenant farmers next year simply unable to pay their rent. And also, of course, the hike in national insurance for employers. Again, very difficult for businesses on the small margins that farms operate on. But when you speak to farmers, they're not in it for the money. My goodness me, you'll see for yourself today how hard our farmers work. It is a 365-day responsibility. And one of the greatest strengths, I think, of British farming is that we have nurtured tax policy so as to protect the family farm and enable, for example, tenant farmers to continue farming their families. The shame of this budget is that this Labour government doesn't get it. They don't seem to understand the impacts that this policy will have on British farming. And my worry is that this Labour government is setting the sun on family farming across the United Kingdom.
Isn't the truth that this actually affects far fewer farmers than your team has suggested? And I'll quote Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. The changes will affect a remarkably small number of the most valuable farms. And that's because, in fact, you've got a lot of people, a fair number of rich people, putting money into land simply so they don't have to pay inheritance tax on it.
Forgive me, it's not me talking about these figures. It is farmers, it is farming accountants, it is farm business advisors, it is the NFU, the CLA, the Tenant Farmers Association. It is farmers themselves telling me. I'll give you an example. I spoke to a farmer yesterday, a 450-acre farm worth on paper £8 million, an enormous sum of money. But their profits last year were £19,000. £19,000. This is not unusual. This is very, very typical across the industry. And the farmer told me that their 80-year-old father, who is at the moment the owner of this farm, operating his business under the rules that have been in place for years, he is now contemplating whether he should take his life before March 2026, because if he does not pass before then his passing will cost his family £1.2 million. And how on earth is anyone supposed to pay that on £19,000 profit a year? It's killing British farming, and this is why people are so angry.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Let's go straight to the weather with Helen Willetts.
Johnny, thanks very much. We've seen snow falling through the night and this morning. It's now stretching as far south as Oxfordshire. And although not settling on many of the major routes, things will be quite icy where temperatures are below freezing. So for England and Wales, it is primarily a cloudy start with rain and snow. Snow even falling at lower levels. We've had 12 centimetres in Nottingham through the night. It is now clearing, though, from the far north of England. Temperatures are well below freezing, and it's icy here because we've had that rain and snow mix. So some treacherous conditions out and about. Gradually through the day, we'll find that brighter, clearer weather across the north of England slipping southwards, but there'll still be a few showers around. There could still be wintry over the southwest moors across South Wales, for example. There may even be a flurry of snow as that weather front finally clears southern and eastern areas. But it's going to be cold. That's the main feature today. Barely 2 to 5 degrees Celsius. Very different, really, compared with what we've been used to. Northern Ireland is starting on a cold note. The rain and the snow mix is starting to move away from the south, but we will see a few wintry showers, but mostly dry with good spells of sunshine and cold 2 or 3 degrees after the morning frost. Scotland, well, it's frosty with a hard frost actually here. Temperatures well below freezing, -9, -10 in places, and snow showers still to come across the north and the northeast with a brisk wind, and that snow will continue to settle. But for many, dry with lots of sunshine around today, but it will feel cold in that wind.
Thanks, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Johnny Diamond in Wiltshire. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 19th of November. The headlines. Farmers have accused the government of betrayal ahead of a day of protests in London about plans to impose inheritance tax on some farms. I've been speaking to farmers here in Wiltshire about the wider struggles they face.
We're trying to improve what we're doing and the landscape around it for us, for future generations and the wildlife. So when you keep facing these battles, it really is a struggle to carry on.
China has called on world leaders to cool down the crisis in Ukraine after Washington's decision to allow its long-range missiles to be fired into Russia. The Home Secretary is preparing to set out her strategy to reform policing, including a special unit to monitor performance. We'll hear from the policing minister after the news. Also in the next hour, Elon Musk will have another go at what he admitted was a crazy idea, catching a falling rocket today. We'll hear what a game changer it could be for spaceflight. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The president of the National Farmers Union has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on some properties an extraordinary betrayal. Tom Bradshaw is leading a group of his members to Westminster today to lobby their MPs and urge the Chancellor to scrap the policy. A separate rally will take place near Downing Street later in the day. The government insists it's supporting farmers with more financial assistance and that relatively few will be affected by the tax changes. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Ministers will face the most vocal and visual opposition to any government policy since they took office. Labour won some predominantly rural seats for the very first time at the general election, but now the NFU's president, Tom Bradshaw, is accusing the party of betrayal. He's expected to tell his members that he's not known a budget as bad for farming in his lifetime. He'll accuse ministers of failing to consult and of using faulty data which underestimates the impact on farmers. His hope is that when MPs face the wrath of constituents, they'll then put pressure on the Chancellor to change course. Rachel Reeves has said she understands the strength of feeling, but under her plans, the wealthiest estates and the most valuable farms will pay their fair share to invest in the services on which rural communities rely.
Some of Britain's biggest retailers have warned that new costs being imposed on the industry next year will make job losses inevitable and higher prices a certainty. In a letter to the Chancellor, the British Retail Consortium says they could have to absorb an extra £7 billion of costs because of policies announced in the budget. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The letter has been signed by senior figures from more than 70 retail businesses, including the bosses of Tesco, Superdry, The Perfume Shop and Wickes. It says the industry is facing a range of extra costs following the budget, including greater national insurance contributions, an increase in the national living wage and higher taxes on plastic packaging. It says these changes are being brought in too quickly for retailers to absorb and will lead to higher inflation, slower pay growth and shop closures. The British Retail Consortium is also concerned that adjustments to business rates, which are meant to help the industry, are being brought in too slowly and don't go far enough. The government says difficult choices were needed to pay for improvements in public services and greater funding for the NHS.
The leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies meeting in Brazil have issued a statement calling for a comprehensive, just and durable peace in Ukraine. But the G20 communique gave no indication of how this could be achieved and failed to directly criticise Russia's invasion. The Chinese President Xi Jinping, in a separate statement, urged leaders to cool down the conflict. His comments come after President Biden authorised the use of long-range US missiles against targets in Russia. From Rio de Janeiro, here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
Russia is making gains on the battlefield, Ukraine's on the back foot, and world leaders are losing patience. In a joint statement, the G20 complained about the human suffering of the war and its negative impact on global food and energy security. The leaders said they supported constructive initiatives leading to a durable peace. According to Chinese state media, President Xi urged leaders to cool the Ukraine crisis and seek a political solution. He was speaking after the US allowed Kiev to use long-range missiles against targets in Russia. Sir Keir Starmer won't say if the UK will allow Ukraine to use British-built missiles in the same way, citing operational security. But the Prime Minister insists allies should double down on their support for the country.
The US envoy to the United Nations has pledged more security assistance to Ukraine in the coming days. Speaking at a Security Council meeting to mark 1,000 days since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion, Linda Thomas-Greenfield indicated that the help would continue for as long as it was needed.
Ultimately, supporting Ukraine in Congress and beyond it cannot be and should not be a partisan issue. Standing up for democracy and human rights is above petty politics and outlasts any one leader or term.
Commuters in the north of England are being warned of possible disruption to trains because of the cold weather. Merseyrail said early services operated without passengers to ensure tracks were safe. National Rail said there could be problems on a number of routes until early this afternoon. National Highways has issued a snow alert for roads across the northeast and northwest. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will set out plans today to overhaul policing, including establishing a unit dedicated to improving performance. She'll tell a conference of senior officers of the need to rebuild the public's trust and confidence in the work of police. More from our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
Policing has been hit by a number of scandals in recent years, and the Home Secretary wants her speech to open a new chapter. She says the dedicated unit she's creating will pull together national data to monitor police forces' performance and direct improvements in priority areas, including knife crime and violence against women and girls. Separately, a new National Centre for Policing will employ specialists in areas such as forensics and IT to look at how forces could be more efficient. Yvette Cooper will also commit to restoring community patrols through a neighbourhood policing guarantee and investing more than £500 million of extra funding for policing next year.
A court in Hong Kong has sentenced 45 democracy activists to jail in the territory's biggest national security trial since Beijing clamped down on dissent. They'd been found guilty of subversion after organising a vote to choose candidates for elections. Danny Vincent reports from Hong Kong.
Many of the pro-democracy activists had been in detention for close to 4 years.
Some members of the public camped outside the court for 3 days to get a seat. But when the sentence came down, it was swift. The longest sentence of 10 years was handed down to law professor Benny Tai, considered an organiser of the primary elections in 2020, which the authorities deemed to violate the national security law. Outside court, tensions were high. A large number of police watched on as family members of the convicted claimed their loved ones were the victims of political persecution.
British Airways flights across the world have faced delays after a technical fault grounded its planes. Passengers in the UK and in cities such as Hamburg and Naples began reporting problems at around 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. In a statement, BA said the issue had been resolved and that flights were operating as normal. New York is to become the first US city to introduce a congestion charge similar to London. Drivers will pay $9 a day to travel in the southern part of Manhattan between Central Park and the Staten Island Ferry. More from our North America correspondent, Rowan Bridge.
New York faces the same problems many cities are struggling with: interminable congestion on its streets and a creaking public transport network. The new congestion charge is aimed at tackling both. The scheme will come into effect in the new year and aims to raise billions of dollars to repair the metro system while discouraging drivers from taking to the clogged up roads. The proposal was first floated by New York State's Governor Kathy Hochul in June last year, but she hit the brakes on it after complaints from some commuters and businesses. Now a revised version of the plan has been approved. Not everyone's a fan, though. New Yorker and President-elect Donald Trump has said he strongly disagrees with the idea. He's already faced calls from a Republican congressman to scrap it when he takes office.
Rowan Bridge reporting.
Lisa, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. Well, you may have heard Seema Kotecha's report in the bulletin there. There are big changes to British policing being announced today. A new police performance unit to monitor standards and performances, a national centre for policing to collate data and look for savings, and there's a broad push, we're told, to prioritise areas like violent crime, such as knife crime, and £500 million of extra funding. But this comes against the backdrop of several major scandals in recent years, diminishing levels of public trust, the Met Commissioner telling Nick's Political Thinking podcast last week that he is, and I quote, deeply troubled by the financial situation we appear to be heading towards, and scrutiny over the growing prevalence of so-called non-criminal hate incidents. Just a few moments ago, I spoke to Dame Diana Johnson, the policing minister, about today's announcement.
Can I just say, first of all, that these are major police reforms that the Home Secretary is announcing today. We haven't seen anything like this since probably the 1960s. And one of the points that you've just raised there is about identifying data and performance and being able to see across the piece, the 43 police forces, what's actually going on. And if I give you an example, I asked recently my officials, could they tell me how many police officers had been injured in the riots over the summer and what had happened to them? And I was told that we didn't hold that information centrally in the Home Office. We'd have to write to the 43 police forces. So that gives you an indication of why we want to get at the centre in the Home Office a police performance unit where we can get the data of what's going on in police forces around the country on those really important issues that the government has identified, like halving violence against women and girls and halving knife crime over the next decade.
And so what will happen to the forces that are failing?
Well, by identifying early on what's going on, we can make sure we put in the support that's required to those police forces. So we've got the Inspectorate, we've got the College of Policing. We want to make sure that those bodies are able to get in and support police forces where they're not performing as well as we need them to. So it's about working with the police and making sure that we identify early on where there are problems.
You mentioned support, and of course there's more to support, as you say, than finances, but on the finances, I think you're announcing £500 million of extra funding. The view of the police is very clear. They would say that that doesn't begin to touch the sides of what is needed. And isn't the truth that, as the Met Commissioner said to my colleague Nick on his Political Thinking podcast last week, isn't the truth that police finances, like those of so many public services, I'm not saying this is Labour's fault, but they're in critical condition?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, when Labour came into power in the summer, we found this black hole in the public finances, $22 billion, that we are having to make some really difficult decisions on. But the fact is that there is £500 million additional money going into policing that the Home Secretary will be talking about today. And we value the police. We want to make sure that they have the resources that they need. And so one of the other things we're doing is working with policing to identify where there are efficiencies that can be undertaken, where the police forces can work together in collaboration to make the savings so we can reinvest it in policing. So I fully accept that it's a really tight position for police forces to be in, as it is across the public sector. But there is a real commitment from this government to support policing and to work with policing.
You say you value the police. The Police Federation of England and Wales, which represents 145,000 members, say police pay is down 17% in real terms since 2010. That's obviously something that happened under Conservatives and the Coalition rather than Labour. But do you think, briefly, that police deserve better pay?
Well, of course, we accepted the findings around the police pay this year. That was funded. Additional money went into police forces to make sure that they could meet that pay award. So, of course, I want to see police officers properly remunerated. They do a really difficult job to keep us all safe day in, day out. But we have a mechanism for deciding on police pay. And as I say, this year we accepted those recommendations.
There's a major protest in London today, and it concerns farming, which I want to move on to, please. And the leader of the National Farmers Union has accused your government of an extraordinary betrayal. Have Britain's farmers got a point?
Well, I don't accept that. Again, we found ourselves in a really difficult position to deal with the mess that was left under the previous Conservative governments, with this big black hole in our national finances. We're having to make some really difficult decisions. But it's also important to note that there's £5 billion going into farming over the next 2 years. The effect of the changes that the Chancellor has introduced around farms is going to affect a very small number of farms. So I think, you know, the farming community have absolutely the right to protest today and to lobby Parliament. But I think, you know, in the scale of things that we're having to deal with, this is a fair approach that the Chancellor's identified.
Might only affect a small number of farms, particularly after the exemptions that have now been put in. But there are thousands of farmers heading to London as we speak right now because they think that your party doesn't have the first idea of what it's like to try and be a farmer in Britain. And it's not just them. It's actually, there's a Labour peer, Baroness Malilieu, I'm sure you've seen. She said that Labour has become an urban party divorced from much of the rural community. And that's when you've got 100 rural MPs. Has she got a point?
Well, look, I fully appreciate the strength of feeling and the fact that there are many farmers who are coming to London to lobby Parliament today. But you're absolutely right. We do in Parliament now have a lot of Labour rural MPs, and that means that the concerns of the rural communities, and I'm particularly looking at rural crime, those issues are very much being addressed by the new government. We are very cognizant of those concerns, and we want to work with rural communities to make sure, in my case as the policing minister, that the neighbourhood policing guarantee will work in neighbourhoods out in rural areas just as much as in urban areas as well.
But if all this raises a mere £200 million, a lot of money, but not much in the context of the broader public finances, is that economic and financial gain really worth the political pain you're about to endure?
Well, look, these are the decisions that the Chancellor set out in the budget. It's part of a package of measures. We're having to take difficult decisions at this time because of the inheritance that we were given in July. I'm not shying away from how difficult this is, but these are the decisions to rebuild the foundations of this country and get our public finances back on an even keel.
Dame Diana Johnson, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 16 minutes past seven. Hong Kong's national security laws, launched in response to the pro-democracy protests which filled the territory's streets in 2019. Those laws were controversial from the start, but their full effect is now becoming clear. A few hours ago, 45 democracy activists were sent to jail for years, one for a decade, the most extensive use so far of the new security legislation. The security minister in Hong Kong said a few moments ago that the sentences reflected the severity of the crimes. Emily Lau is former chair of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong, former member of the Legislative Council. She was outside the courthouse. She joins us now from Hong Kong. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Emily. What is your reaction to these sentences? Did they surprise you when they were handed down?
Well, not really. I mean, I wasn't born yesterday, but we are very, very distressed. And their families, of course, are devastated. And I guess many Hong Kong people are very, very unhappy. Some people had thought that the authorities would use the occasion to show that Hong Kong is turning over a new page. What happened in the past is past. Now we have stability, we have prosperity, and people can enjoy more freedom, personal safety, and the rule of law. But alas, we've got the sentencing this morning. I myself and hundreds of others could not get in because the court was full. And anyway, I mean, we are very, very distressed. And of course, yesterday I saw on television British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer was meeting Chinese President Xi Jinping in Rio de Janeiro at the G20 meeting. I don't know. I'm not against people making money, but I certainly hope that the British government, the Prime Minister, will stand up for the rights that they promised Hong Kong people in the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration, and also the Chinese promulgated the basic law for us in 1990. But it seems all these promises, these rights, rule of law and all that are sort of evaporating.
In the sentencing, no doubt there was a message being sent. Deterrence is always part of sentencing, isn't it? Do you think this is going to mean the end of democratic protest in Hong Kong when people see these sentences and think, well, I'm not going out there?
Well, actually, in the past few years, there were no permissions granted for marches, for demonstrations anyway. So it's very, very quiet, very peaceful. But that's not Hong Kong. If you've been to Hong Kong, you know Hong Kong is a city of protests, very colourful, very safe, very vibrant. But not anymore. With the national security law, with so many people locked up, these people that were sentenced this morning, they were arrested on the very same day that the supporters of Donald Trump stormed Capitol Hill. And now Trump is about to become president again. And these people are languishing in jail. For what? They did not kill anybody, harm anybody. No property was damaged. They just took part in a primary election. What kind of crime is that?
Emily Lau, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us.
19 minutes past seven, a group of the UK's biggest retailers are warning that tax rises in the budget will lead to inevitable job losses and certain price rises. Sean's back with more on that.
Yes, inevitable and certain, that those words coming from the letter coordinated by the British Retail Consortium, but signed by these 75 or more business leaders from the bosses of the biggest supermarkets, Amazon, Next and plenty more, listing national insurance changes, living wage increases, new packaging levies costing the industry an extra £7 billion next year. One of the signatories is Nick Stowe, chief executive of Monsoon and Accessorize, 150 stores in the UK, 200 abroad, employing 2,000 people here. More Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
Are job losses and price rises inevitable at your business?
Well, I think they are, unfortunately. I think people will manage it differently across the retail sector. For us, we want to protect our employees as much as we can. But we're going to have to pass these costs on or avoid them. And that does mean that we're going to flow them through into probably price increases. It does mean that we'll probably roll out fewer stores in the near term. And that's really unfortunate. It certainly isn't a path to growth.
In April, before the election or the budget, you talked about your business seeing an increasingly difficult trading landscape as sales fell. Is it fair to say that if there are fewer jobs or stores for many retailers, it may be because of longer-term difficulties, not necessarily because of those introduced in the budget?
Well, I think the economy has struggled over the past few years, and we've certainly felt that. But that doesn't mean that we can't grow the business. It doesn't mean that we can't prevail with better product and better services. These cost increases just make that incredibly difficult. It piles on the pressure. It makes it much more difficult for us to invest in the things that we want to invest in. And so it makes the situation much worse for us.
So if you employ 2,000 people, if the policies all stay the same, what would you be looking to do with that staff number?
Well, I think we're trying to protect that staff number, and it's about choices in terms of how we protect it. And so for us, it means passing on some of the cost increases in terms of increased prices. It also means we're probably going to have to divert investment that we would have made in growing our store base into protecting the stores that we have and the employees that we have. So it's about making choices. None of those choices are great paths forward for us. None of them lead to growth. I think that's what the retail industry as a whole is concerned about. These are forcing us to do things that seem to be entirely counter to the government's agenda in terms of growing the economy, growing sectors like ours.
Just very briefly, Nick, when would those price rises come in?
Well, they're going to have to come in, you know, alongside the tax increases, and so that means we're looking at those from the spring of next year. Mm. It's not something that we want to do.
No.
I think we've written to the Chancellor to see if we can have the timing of these changes adjusted, to see if we can get a more rational plan in place in terms of the tax burden on the industry, but
Nick,
we'll see if that happens.
Thank you. Nick Stowe there, Chief Executive of Monsoon and Accessorize.
23 minutes past seven. Thanks, Sean. 2 years ago, before he turned his mind to defeating what he calls the woke mind virus, Elon Musk described an idea that even he considered, well, bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty crazy. I mean, there's a custom-built tower with arms that are designed to catch the largest and heaviest flying object ever made and pluck it out of the air.
And yet he and his team did it just a few weeks ago, which brings reusable rockets, perhaps capable of transporting cargo to Mars, much, much closer. Plucking a rocket the size of a giant skyscraper out of the sky, as Musk said there, the heaviest flying object ever made, just plucked out of the air, is one of the great feats of modern engineering. And tonight, Musk's company, SpaceX, are doing it again. Professor Martin Mayfield Tulip is head of the University of Sheffield's School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering, and a professor of engineering design, and joins us now. Professor Mayfield Tulip, good morning.
Good morning.
For those who saw the footage but haven't spent a lifetime in engineering, can you just explain what we actually witnessed? What actually happened when that flying object was plucked out of the sky, and why was it so special?
Well, I mean, it's an incredible feat of engineering. You know, getting man to Mars or getting humanity to Mars is an incredible challenge, and there's a lot of iterations along the way, and one of those iterations is to be able to capture and reuse your vehicles. And I think what SpaceX have done there is they've realised that the landing gear for that kind of equipment, something at that scale, is huge and complex and adds to the weight of the vehicle. So what they've done in this case is to say, rather than adding that weight to the vehicle, we're going to build a structure on the ground that will capture it, thereby making it the actual vehicle less complex, and moving some of the rest to the ground. It's quite an elegant solution.
How do they do it? How do they get that sort of, with the rocket boosters, how do they manoeuvre it back into position?
So the bottom part of the rocket, the Super Heavy, has 33 engines on the bottom. Most of them, there's a circle around the edge, and then most of them are clustered in the middle. And the ones clustered in the middle are on gimbals so that they can move around. And then they have, obviously, the telemetry systems in the rocket allows them to bring that in and guide it in. The thing to remember, really, is that when this thing takes off, it's about 5,000 tonnes. And most of that, 93% of that, is fuel. So once it's expended its fuel, that bottom part of Starship only weighs about 350 tonnes. So it's nothing like the vehicle that went up earlier.
Yeah. I was going to say, but all of this must be extraordinarily inspiring to engineers like you and your student, Professor Mayfield Tulip. And I wonder if it strikes you that it's interesting that NASA seem relatively cautious compared to SpaceX. So maybe it needs an individual, an engineer, and a world historical figure like Musk to force humanity forward.
I think it's been fascinating to watch the difference in pace. I mean, as you say, NASA have been developing the technologies that are going to take humanity to the moon, and about the same rate SpaceX are looking at taking humanity to Mars and dropping off some people on the moon on the way there, as it were. and the way they've done that is through that iteration. So Whereas NASA takes a kind of hardware approach, very cautious, very careful. SpaceX take a software approach to building their hardware. They iterate quickly, they learn from those mistakes, and they move on. So it really is iteration to evolve. And what you've seen over time really is people like Porsche, the 911, that took 40 years to iterate. The iPhone's taken about a decade. SpaceX are doing that kind of iteration in months rather than years, yeah. Which is what's allowing them to move so quickly.
Absolutely astonishing. And I should just finally mention that it's 2026 is a key date in all this, because that's when the Earth and Mars are going to be very close to each other. Professor Martin Mayfield Tulip from the University of Sheffield, thank you very much indeed.
It's 27 minutes past seven and Cathy's got the sport. Cathy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Scotland will have a Nations League playoff in March to decide their status in the competition after a 2-1 win over Poland last night. The Scotland captain, Andy Robertson, scored their winner in the 93rd minute of the game. Northern Ireland were 2-0 ahead but drew to all with Luxembourg. That's, however, enough for Northern Ireland to be promoted to League B in the Nations League. And Wales host Iceland tonight and need to win that match to win the group and secure their return to the top tier of the Nations League. They also need other results to go their way. Now, the 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal will retire from tennis this week after representing Spain in the men's team event, the Davis Cup, in Malaga. Spain play the Netherlands in the quarterfinals today, 20 years after Nadal made his debut as a relatively unknown 18-year-old in the Davis Cup alongside Feliciano López. López won the Davis Cup title with Spain four times and is one of Nadal's closest friends. I've been speaking to him about Nadal's final week of competitive tennis at the age of 38.
Well, for sure it's going to be very emotional for him. There's a lot of things, you know, going through his mind, of course, because although he knows it's going to be his final professional tournament, when this moment arrives, it's very tough to deal with. But I'm sure he's ready to compete at a very good level, and I think it's going to be a great day for Rafa, for Spain, and for everyone here in Malaga.
You played alongside Nadal in the 2004 Davis Cup team when Nadal was 18 years old. He's been unbeaten in the Davis Cup in singles matches in 20 years. Do you think that's partly why he's chosen to retire at the Davis Cup?
I think he's been always very happy and he's been always willing to play Davis Cup. He loves, he personally loves team competitions. So that's really one of the reasons. And it's such a coincidence that in 2004, when he made his Davis Cup debut, that year we end up winning the Davis Cup, and this is won against Roddick in Seville, and that was probably the first big turning point in his career. And it's such a coincidence that 20 years after, he's going to finish here in Malaga. He's chosen, you know, Davis Cup to be the competition that he's going to be playing at his final tournament.
It's interesting that Andy Murray retired at the Olympics and Roger Federer retired at the team event, the Laver Cup, despite all of their individual success. It's the team event they love, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the team event that they love. One of the reasons that Davis Cup is so special is that, you know, normally we compete as individuals. Tennis is an individual sport, so you don't have the opportunity to share, you know, your emotions, your feelings with your teammates. And that's why this competition is so special. So it's crazy that Andy, Roger and Rafa, they'll be playing team competitions, you know, as their last tournament of their careers. It's such a good coincidence.
There's lots of debate in this country about the greatest British sports person. Is there any debate about whether the 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafa Nadal is Spain's greatest sports person?
Well, not really. I don't think this should be a debate, but of course in the media it's always, you know, they keep asking. We think that he's the best, you know, athlete in the history of our country, and with all the respect for others, you know, athletes that we've had in the past, but I think Rafa belongs to a very special group that only him and, you know, athletes in the world, and he's one of them.
I hope you can enjoy the occasion. Feliciano López, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cathy.
Certainly going to be an emotional day. Now in the women's team event, the Billie Jean King Cup, Great Britain face Slovakia in the semi-finals today. They're attempting to reach the final for the first time since 1981. And you can watch that BJK Cup semi-final on the BBC iPlayer and app from 11 o'clock this morning.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. This evening's new 6:30 comedy is prescribed by Kiri Pritchard-McLean.
Best medicine. Dissecting funny and fascinating medicine.
I think pain management is the best medicine.
Bibliotherapy. Therapy by books.
Sleep.
Oh. Well,
Spot the comedian.
Celebrating medicine's past, present and future.
I think transplantation is the best medicine because it can completely change someone's life.
Defibrillation.
Oh, defibrillators, okay. Amazing machines, that much is clear. Sorry, clear! That's the new series of Best Medicine with me, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. Tuesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's take a quick look at the weather. It's 28 minutes to 8 today. Rain and hill snow will end for most areas. Blustery snow showers will continue in the far north, and it is going to be cold.
Coming up in about 10 minutes on this programme, we're going to survey the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe. Before we do that, before we get the news, Johnny, just describe where you are and the scene around you as you're presenting the Today programme. Not next to me in the studio, but in Wiltshire today.
I hope you're not missing me too much, Amol. I am in lovely Wiltshire, about half an hour outside Salisbury. I would say the sun has come up, but I'm not sure it's the sun. At least it's light. The rain appears to have stopped, and there is gorgeous British green countryside all around us. We're going to be talking farms and farming in the rest of the programme too. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and with Johnny Diamond. Let's get a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
The president of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw, has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on some properties an extraordinary betrayal. He will lead a group of his members to Westminster today to lobby MPs and urge the Chancellor to scrap the policy. Farmers are also expected to demonstrate at Downing Street later today. The government insists that relatively few farmers will be affected by the new tax, which will apply to properties worth more than £1 million. The British Retail Consortium has warned that new costs being imposed on the industry next year will make job losses and higher prices for consumers inevitable. In a letter to the Chancellor, the industry body said retailers may have to absorb an extra £7 billion. Tesco, Amazon, Greggs, Next and dozens of other chains are urging the Treasury to reconsider the measures. The government says difficult choices are needed to pay for improvements to public services. World leaders at the G20 summit in Brazil have issued a statement calling for a comprehensive, just and durable peace in Ukraine. The Chinese President Xi Jinping, in a separate statement, urged leaders to cool down the conflict. His comments come after President Biden authorized the use of long-range US missiles on targets in Russia. Commuters in the north of England are being warned of possible disruption because of snow and sleet. Merseyrail said early train services operated without passengers to ensure tracks were safe. National Highways has issued a snow alert for roads across the northeast and northwest. 45 pro-democracy activists have been jailed in Hong Kong's largest ever national security trial. The activists were accused of conspiracy to commit subversion after holding an unofficial election in the territory in 2020. The democracy activist, Benny Tai, received the longest sentence of 10 years. New York will become the first US city to introduce a congestion charge similar to London. From next year, drivers will pay $9 a day to travel in the southern part of Manhattan between Central Park and the Staten Island Ferry.
Thanks, Lisa. It is coming up to 25 minutes to 8. In fact, it is 25 minutes to 8. And I am in lovely Wiltshire this morning, broadcasting from a farmhouse about half an hour outside Salisbury. The farming day started some time ago, but across the country, a fair number of farmers will be absent from their fields and animals today as they are heading to London for a mass lobby and a march to protest at the change in the last budget that would see those inheriting farms pay 20% inheritance tax on properties worth more than £1 million. Previous to the budget, agricultural land was not taxed upon death. It received what's called agricultural property relief, APR. There are a lot of very upset farmers around. They do not believe the government's analysis that as few as 500 estates a year will actually be effective. They believe that this will lead to the breakup of farms that have been in families for generations. I went to talk farming and tax with a family farmer not far from here. Richard Jowett runs a 300-acre farm just outside Salisbury in Wiltshire. On a grey and drizzly day, he's checking some of the problem sheep
he has inside a barn. Most are out in the distinctly damp fields.
Yeah, so the problem is it's been so wet that if you look at a sheep's feet, they get absolutely saturated.
This farm is essentially a chalk downland farm, and it is a small farm of about 300 acres. It was purchased by my grandfather in 1952.
It's your presumption, is it, that you would be hit by the tax change?
In reality, according to the Chancellor's budget, this is the sort of farm that wouldn't get caught. But actually, if you do the sums, it's very much the sort of farm that does get caught. But as it stands at the moment, in simple terms, for this 300-acre farm, including a small house in the village, we would actually end up having to pay £500,000 tax if I died and there was no other provision and one of the children wished to take it over. I went to the CLA conference last year,
the Country Landowners Association, yeah,
and saw Mr. Steve Reed stand up and be interviewed, and he said, no problems about the APR, we will be leaving it alone. He stated that, so at that stage we thought, well, that's very good news, and it was just before Christmas. Happy Christmas, everything will be fine for a while. It just, sadly, you feel totally let down, and
I think you've been lied to.
I think a lie is the very, yes, that's all it is, really. These are a bunch of lambs, effectively, that were born this year. Once they get going, they're quite enthusiastic.
Yes, they are, aren't they? £500,000 for most medium-sized farms, presumably, is a huge sum. The government says you'll have 10 years to pay it off. It's not all in one sum.
I'm sure that the bigger landowners will be getting all their clever lawyers and accountants to go through stuff. And I have a feeling that, ironically, it will probably be the bigger farmers that manage to restructure and come up with some clever scam to get out of it.
Richard's in his 50s and he is thinking pretty hard about that possible inheritance tax bill. Luke is 29 and works on this and other farms. Owning land is a very far away prospect given its price, but the tax changes leave him concerned.
Okay, this is my first tractor. Very exciting moment for me.
Would you like to own a farm one day or have a farm of your own?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, no question. Yeah, that would be absolute number one, but it's not really possible for the average person, I would say.
Because land prices are just insane for a start.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, you know, there's no real chance of setting out without any sort of massive investment to start with.
You are a young farmer, presumably you want to stay in the business for a fair few decades to come. When a change like this sort of thunders down the road, does it make you think, I'm not sure I can make this work? Or you just sort of grit your teeth and it's yet one more thing you've got to get past?
Well, obviously, you know, for myself who doesn't own a farm or anything like that, just working on it, it's also maybe what might come of the future. The way that farming is going, we're working well with the environment. We're trying to improve what we're doing and the landscape around it for us, for future generations and the wildlife. So I think when you keep facing these battles, it really is a struggle to carry on in some ways.
The final word goes back to family farmer Richard Jarrett.
Farms are different, and I don't think that we don't feel special, but they are different, and it's because the land value is so absurd compared to its profitability potential. And I don't know, I'm sure you've seen, or should have seen by now, Mr. Clarkson's farm. His programme showed forever, if you go to any busy-ish farm, the farmyard is full of people coming and going, and half of them are not deriving a livelihood necessarily purely from that farm, but that farm's giving them something. There are the Geralds, there are the people who help chop up trees, there are the people who do different things. And the smaller farms have also got the ability to club together and do more environmental work. If you were a businessman, you wouldn't do it. There are heaps of other ways you could do better. It sounds a bit corny, but it is. It's a sort of a calling rather than just a job.
That was Farmer Richard Jowett speaking to me there. Well, there's lots and lots of numbers being flung around, whether it's the number of people who are affected or the kind of money it might raise to help fight our way through. We're joined by Simon Jack, our business editor. Simon, can you take me first through this enormous disparity that there is between what the government says, the numbers the government says might actually be affected, which is about 500 estates, and the tens of thousands of farms that farming groups say will fall under the new rule?
Right. So the DEFRA Farm Survey says there are around 70,000 farms worth more than £1 million, which is where this threshold has been set. However, when you add up existing tax-free allowances and the exemptions you get from passing on homes, farmhouses, for example, to spouses and families, the threshold can be as high as £3 million. So how does that compare to what's actually happened? Well, in 2022, the most recent numbers, there were 117 farms inherited, which were valued over £2.5 million. Now, not all farming families will qualify for all these exemptions, depending on their family situation. But the number hit by this, by definition, once-in-a-generation tax could be less than 500 a year, according to tax experts and the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And when that happens, they'll have 10 years to pay interest-free. And, of course, you've got the seven-year exemption. You can make a transfer to your family and things drop out of your estate in a tapered way after 7 years. So that's why we've got this massive disparity. Now, that is not to say that farmers are not land rich and cash poor. They've been absolutely clobbered during the cost of living, the cost of doing business crisis. For example, pig farmers, dairy farmers saw their cost rise by about 50% over the last 5 years. That is much higher than the amount they've actually been able to charge. So they're making less than 0.5% on their capital, if you like. So they're feeling like pretty beaten up over the years. And this is just one more kick in the teeth. But there are others who will say that why should the literally landed classes be able to pass their wealth from generation to generation, being totally unmolested by the tax man like everyone else's?
Simon Jack, thank you very much indeed. Our business editor there.
16 minutes to eight. Is there life out there beyond Earth? Well, it depends a bit on what you mean by life, and that in turn depends a bit on the discoveries made in the thrilling field of astrobiology. This is a golden age in the search for extraterrestrial life. The James Webb Telescope, among others, is bringing us amazing imagery and information about distant solar systems. All of it helps to explain who we are, and that life and civilization might just be this tiny candle in the infinite darkness. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the creation of the SETI Institute, that search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So a short time ago, earlier this morning, I tried to decipher the meaning of life with Nathalie Cabrol. She's the director of the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe, and she told me why this is a golden age in the search for life beyond our planet.
When you think that maybe 60 years ago, all we knew, you know, about space, about galaxies, about planets and stars, came from ground-based telescopes. And in a span of, you know, a few decades, we've come to know our solar system like our backyard. Only 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we just discovered that our solar system is just one out of many. It's just a completely new perspective on our place in the universe and the potential for life out there. But remember, whether it's looking at the origins of life or looking at the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, it's very anthropocentric. So we are thinking about life in the universe as if alien were thinking like us, building the same things as we are. I mean, it's a good way to get started.
And if we did find, if we did encounter something that we call life, whatever life may in fact be, where do you think it's most likely? What are the areas that we've discovered through perhaps the James Webb telescope that would give us an indication of where we ought to be looking?
In the solar system, it's not going to be an advanced technological civilization beside us. We know that, if there is life in the solar system, it's going to be microbial. Exoplanets are tricky because they are far away. We can access the information only remotely, which means by, you know, spectroscopy and looking through their atmosphere. A good indication for exoplanet would be if we were going to find kind of a synthetic molecule or something that cannot be only created by the environment only. Basically, what we are looking for is pollution in another atmosphere. feel, like something that says to us that somewhere someone is messing with their environment in the same way that we are. And then the techno signature one could be messages. And that's why we're listening. There could be laser light signals as well. And there could be also the type of message we have no clue about. Maybe this message is already all around us, but we don't have the technology yet.
And in the end, what this search does is it helps us understand what it is to be human, doesn't it? Because the point about this search deep into distant space is it makes us realize that whole, you know, life and civilization on this blue marble dangling in the infinite blackness is an extraordinarily precious thing.
All the questions that we are directed towards the universe or towards the solar system are, in fact, a reflection of the questions that we have about ourselves. And what we are learning, doing, you know, this journey is really about what habitability means, what are environmental thresholds, what it takes to keep a planet habitable. Basically, we are learning what it is to be a planetary citizen.
And compared to when you started out in this field a few decades ago, are you feeling more optimistic or less optimistic that we will find information that suggests that we are not alone?
I like the few decades ago you. Copernicus told us that we're not the center, you know, of the solar system and the universe. And Kepler is telling us not only we are not that, but we are one out of many, many solar systems out there. Every time you look at the star, there is a planet, at least one, orbiting around it. And that changes completely the way we're perceiving ourselves and the way we're perceiving the universe around us.
Natalie Cabral, Director of the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's just coming up to 11 minutes to 8. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinny McDonald, Director of Theos, the Religion and Society think tank.
Good morning. For those not glued to such things, over the weekend, Miss Nigeria narrowly missed out on being crowned Miss Universe, losing out to Miss Denmark. There's something anachronistic and, in my opinion, vacuous and sexist about beauty contests, but I was drawn to the headlines about this one because Miss Nigeria, Chidinma Adetshina, bears a name from the same ethnic group as my own, the Igbos of southeastern Nigeria. It's also caught my eye because over the weekend, my family and friends gathered for an elaborate traditional Igbo wedding to mark my younger sister getting married. 200 people wearing bright fabrics with shimmering gold sequins and prints, with head ties and coral beads. A celebration of Nigerian culture in the middle of Hampshire. Our culture was also celebrated during the Miss Universe competition, with Adetshina sporting a headpiece crafted with more than 10,000 coral pearls, cowrie shells, stones and feathers. Honouring the traditions, cultures and spirit of Nigeria, it's intended to be a vibrant symbol of unity. The headpiece is called an Njikaka, taken from the Igbo word that means unity is better or unity is best. These positive symbols of unity, both the headpiece and my sister's wedding celebration, get to the heart of the intention described in the Gospels, where Jesus tells the story of a king who throws a wedding banquet for his child as a way of describing what the kingdom of God is like. Everyone's invited. He sends his servants out compelling people to come, irrespective of their differences. The book of Ephesians too speaks of the good news of Christ as signalling the breaking down of what's described as the dividing wall of hostility, a wall that separates and fragments and divides. The early church in many ways reflected this unity, people from different backgrounds coming together, but in many ways it was also like our culture today, fractured, isolated, polarised. My sister's Nigerian wedding was a feast for the eyes and the belly. It represented a fusion of cultures, a melting pot of different identities, languages, nations and dance moves. Guests came from London and Lagos and Leeds. For a few hours, we were able to forget that outside, both in the UK and in Nigeria, the world isn't always a place where we come together despite our differences. Beauty contests and dance floors feel a long way from climate catastrophe, riots and death tolls. But maybe there's something special in recognising that in these pockets of forgetting, there's a way of seeing things differently, even if just for a few hours. and maybe one antidote to existential dread and anxiety, conflict and polarisation that we should embrace from time to time is a whopping great big party.
Chinny, thank you. That was Thought for the Day with Chinny McDonald. The time now is 8 minutes to eight. Today marks 1,000 days since Russia's reinvasion of Ukraine. The decision by Joe Biden to change his mind and let President Zelensky use US-made long-range missiles to attack targets deep inside Russia may not make a huge difference to the war effort against Vladimir Putin's country, but it will boost Ukrainian morale and strengthen that country's negotiating position ahead of Donald Trump's forthcoming presidency. It does also bring a direct confrontation between America and Russia somewhat closer. Or perhaps not just America and Russia, but the rival systems in a new, mostly Cold War between a fatigued West and a new alliance you might call the Crinklies, China, Russia, Iran and North Korea. Well, on this programme 2 years ago, on the morning of the invasion, we spoke to General Sir Richard Shireff, former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander for NATO in Europe and the author in 2017 of War with Russia, an urgent warning from senior military command. And this is what he said.
Absolutely, there is a possibility that we as a nation will be at war with Russia. Because if Russia puts one boot step across NATO territory, we are all at war with Russia.
Well, General Sir Richard Shireff joins us again now. General, good morning.
Good morning, Amal, and thank you for having me.
Well, is the warning that you gave us 2 years ago about to be realised?
We will see. It all depends on the West. It all depends on NATO, and it all depends on American leadership of NATO. If NATO stays strong, remains strong, but also builds up its capability to deter any Russian aggression, then there will not be war between Russia and NATO. If the West is weak, if the West does not wake up to the reality that Ukraine is facing defeat, and give Ukraine the means not only to protect itself, but to defeat Russia and Ukraine, then I do fear for the future.
Why do you say Ukraine is facing defeat?
Because the Russians are advancing relentlessly, slowly, at enormous cost certainly in the east of the country. The Ukrainians are not able to keep up with the material demands of a war of attrition in the way that the Russians are doing at the moment. And the West has not given Ukraine the means to defeat Russia.
It's impossible to know, of course, it's impossible to know how Putin will respond to the change of policy this week from Joe Biden. But how might that change of policy in the short term change the dynamics of this war? Would it be not very much?
Well, I think not very much. And I've seen one statement from the State Department on open source intelligence saying that it's not intended to change the dynamic of the war very much. And you have to remember that also that the yes, it's good news that the Ukrainians have been given permission to use attackums to strike targets in Russia, but it's limited. It's limited to those targets in the Kursk region. They're not, as I understand, allowed to use them elsewhere. So it'll certainly help in the Kursk region, and it'll help them to target concentrations of troops, forming up positions for likely attacks, logistic installations, airfields, and the like.
I'm seeing it.
But is it going to change the dynamic? Not without a wholesale effort from NATO and the West to really double down, which has not happened.
Sorry to interrupt. I just see a story at the top of the Daily Telegraph, right-hand side. Storm shadows ready for use in Russia after US green light. Britain is poised to allow Ukraine to fire storm shadow missiles inside Russia for the first time. If the Defence Secretary called you up, General, this morning and said, what do you think we should do with these storm shadows? What would you say?
I'd say go for it.
Why?
Absolutely go for it. Because the Ukraine needs all the support and help it can get. And the only way, as I say, that Russia is going to be slowed down is by the use of long-range precision missiles and other capabilities as well.
Are we in the foothills of a new Cold War, not against the Soviet Union, but against an alliance of autocrats?
The very best is that we're in the foothills of a Cold War, because we're going to have to fight a second Cold War to prevent a third World War. The worst case is that we're in the foothills of a war between Russia and NATO if we don't recognize that Russia is not going to change its intent to remove Ukraine from the map as a sovereign state. And once it's finished in Ukraine, it'll move on elsewhere. Moldova, Georgia, already in jeopardy. And who knows, they may well decide to have a crack at the Baltic states at some stage in the future when they've rebuilt, regenerated, and retrained their armed forces.
Given what's just happened in America, do you fear that President Zelensky is running out of friends?
Well, we'll see. But designate President Trump has said he'll stop the war in a day. I think that's highly unlikely.
General Sir Richard Sheriff, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
On BBC iPlayer.
You have few friends, Cromwell. Because of what you are, they don't know how to deal with you.
The conclusion of the BAFTA and Golden Globe winning series Wolf Hall.
The king never does an unpleasant thing. Lord Cromwell does it for him.
Starring Damian Lewis.
My patience is not infinite, neither with you nor my daughter.
And Mark Rylance.
When negotiation and compromise fail, and your only course is to destroy your enemy before they wake in the morning, have the axe in your hand.
The new series of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
And it is fantastic. It's just coming up to 8 o'clock. Let's get the weather with Helen Willis.
Thank you very much indeed, Johnny. Hello there. Good morning. It is cold out there right now and the snow is falling as well. Let's start the detail in England and Wales, where for many away from Northern England, we are swathed in cloud with rain in the south, but snow quite widely falling across Wales, the Midlands, southern parts of Northern England, and now down into the home counties, into central London, we're seeing a few flakes of snow as well. It is a real wintry mix out there. It's tending not to settle on the wet roads, but nevertheless, there could be some rather slippery surfaces around. And that's all making its way southwards for the next few hours. Expect more. Further north, however, we wake to sunshine now across Northern England and a scattering of wintry showers. And that clearer weather with sunny spells will push a bit further southwards as we go through the remainder of the day. Eventually, that rain, sleet and snow mix clearing away from the south as we head towards tea time. But it will be a cold day for all. We started at 10 or 11 the south, but temperatures will fall here, rising to around about 2 to 7 generally. So it's a bitterly cold feeling day. Do wrap up warmly. Let's move to Northern Ireland, where that mix of wintry weather is clearing away and we'll have some sunshine coming through the clouds. But also there will be a few showers developing, particularly on the north coast, and a chilly breeze. Temperatures barely 2 or 3 degrees after a chilly, frosty start. And it certainly is a frosty start across Scotland, well below freezing, a hard frost, and therefore ice and snow a risk in the north. The snow showers still coming in thick and fast to the far north of Scotland and the islands at the moment, and that will continue. Sunshine in the south, but only 2 or 3 are high today.
Thank you, Helen. Plenty of snow here in central London, which made the school run so much more interesting. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 19th of November. The headlines. Farmers are calling on the government to scrap plans to impose inheritance tax on some properties as they prepare for a day of protests at Westminster. After the news, we'll hear more about that and the wider concerns of farmers here in Wiltshire. China is urging world leaders to cool down the crisis in Ukraine after America approved the firing of its missiles into Russia. The Home Secretary will set out her strategy to reform policing, including a unit to monitor the performance of all forces.
And coming up in the next hour, in a remarkable advance, two new digital therapies are being proposed for Tourette's. We'll hear how they might help. New Zealand has seen one of its biggest protests in years over plans to overhaul the original treaty between the Maori people and British colonisers. And just before 9 o'clock, we go inside the Mercedes F1 racing team with former driver and now team principal Toto Wolff, who's going to be speaking to us exclusively. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The president of the National Farmers Union has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on some properties an extraordinary betrayal. Tom Bradshaw is leading a group of his members to Westminster today to lobby their MPs and urge the Chancellor to scrap the policy. A separate rally will take place near Downing Street later in the day. The government insists it's supporting farmers with more financial assistance and that relatively few will be affected by the tax changes. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Ministers will face the most vocal and visual opposition to any government policy since they took office. Labour won some predominantly rural seats for the very first time at the general election, but now the NFU's president, Tom Bradshaw, is accusing the party of betrayal. He's expected to tell his members that he's not known a budget as bad for farming in his lifetime. He'll accuse ministers of failing to consult and of using faulty data which underestimates the impact on farmers. His hope is that when MPs face the wrath of constituents, they'll then put pressure on the Chancellor to change course. Rachel Reeves has said she understands the strength of feeling, but under her plans, the wealthiest estates and the most valuable farms will pay their fair share to invest in the services on which rural communities rely.
The Conservatives' environment spokesperson, Victoria Atkins, told us the policy was cruel and would kill British farming.
One of the greatest strengths, I think, of British farming is that we have nurtured tax policy so as to protect the family farm. The shame of this budget is that this Labour government doesn't get it. They don't seem to understand the impacts that this policy will have on British farming. And my worry is that this Labour government is setting the sun on family farming.
The changes will mean a tax of 20% being levied on farms worth more than £1 million. The NFU and the government disagree about how many will be affected. Ben Chu from BBC Verify has been looking at the conflicting information.
There are about 209,000 farm holdings in the UK, and farming groups say up to 70,000 of them, or one third, will be hit by the changes. The government, on the other hand, estimates that no more than 27% will be affected, or fewer than 500 a year. The 70,000 figure looks like a considerable overestimate, while the Treasury's figure is based on the number of claims made for agricultural property relief from inheritance tax in the 2020-2021 tax year. Farmers have also argued that even if their land is worth more than £1 million, the new threshold for inheritance tax, that does not make them wealthy. Some support is given to this by official figures which show the average return on capital for farms, essentially the money farmers can earn whether by growing crops or grazing livestock, is only about 0.5%, which is low by the standards of other businesses.
Some of Britain's biggest retailers have warned that new costs being imposed on the industry next year will make job losses inevitable and higher prices a certainty. In a letter to the Chancellor, the British Retail Consortium says they could have to absorb an extra £7 billion of costs because of measures announced in the budget and other government policies. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The letter has been signed by senior figures from more than 70 retail businesses, including the bosses of Tesco, Superdry, The Perfume Shop and Wickes. It says the industry is facing a range of extra costs following the budget, including greater national insurance contributions, an increase in the national living wage and higher taxes on plastic packaging. It says these changes are being brought in too quickly for retailers to absorb and will lead to higher inflation, slower pay growth and shop closures. The British Retail Consortium is also concerned that adjustments to business rates, which are meant to help the industry, are being brought in too slowly and don't go far enough. The government says difficult choices were needed to pay for improvements in public services and greater funding for the NHS.
The leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies meeting in Brazil have issued a statement calling for a comprehensive, just and durable peace in Ukraine. But the G20 communique gave no indication of how this could be achieved and failed to directly criticise Russia's invasion. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, in a separate statement, urged leaders to cool down the conflict. His comments come after President Biden authorised the use of long-range US missiles against targets in Russia. From Rio de Janeiro, here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Russia is making gains on the battlefield, Ukraine's on the back foot, and world leaders are losing patience. In a joint statement, the G20 complained about the human suffering of the war and its negative impact on global food and energy security. The leaders said they supported constructive initiatives leading to a durable peace. According to Chinese state media, President Xi urged leaders to cool the Ukraine crisis and seek a political solution. He was speaking after the US allowed Kyiv to use long-range missiles against targets in Russia. Sir Keir Starmer won't say if the UK will allow Ukraine to use British-built missiles in the same way, citing operational security. But the Prime Minister insists allies should double down on their support for the country.
Commuters in the north of England are being warned of possible disruption to trains because of the cold weather. Merseyrail said early services operated without passengers to ensure tracks were safe. National Rail said there could be problems on a number of routes until early this afternoon. National Highways has issued a snow alert for roads across the northeast and northwest, and dozens of schools in the Powys, Wrexham and Flintshire areas of Wales have been forced to close because of the conditions. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will set out plans today to overhaul policing. They include establishing a unit dedicated to improving performance and investing more than £500 million into the sector next year. She'll tell a conference of senior officers of the need to rebuild the public's trust and confidence in the work of the police. The policing minister, Dame Diana Johnson, told this programme that the new measures were designed to support struggling forces.
By identifying early on what's going on, we can make sure we put in the support that's required to those police forces. So we've got the inspectorate, we've got the College of Policing. We want to make sure that those bodies are able to get in and support police forces where they're not performing as well as we need them to.
Figures show that almost £2 million in compensation has been claimed as a result of the widespread disorder across the UK in the summer. The Association of Police and Crime Commissioners says 88 separate claims have been registered under the Riot Compensation Act so far. Alex Hattonstone reports.
After three girls were killed in Southport in July, misinformation about the attackers spread and hundreds of people were involved in violence. Under the Riot Compensation Act, claims can be made for property that isn't adequately covered by insurance for riot-related damage. Most payouts come from local police and crime commissioners or mayor's offices. The Association of Police and Crime Commissioners says the figure of nearly £2 million will likely change and doesn't represent what might actually be paid. The total financial cost of the riots will almost certainly be much higher when those who had adequate insurance are taken into account. The government says in many cases the damage is still being assessed, and ministers have been meeting those affected to determine how best to support them.
A court in Hong Kong has sentenced 45 democracy activists to jail in the territory's biggest national security trial since Beijing clamped down on dissent. They've been found guilty of subversion after organising a vote to choose candidates for elections. Danny Vincent reports from Hong Kong.
Many of the pro-democracy activists had been in detention for close to 4 years. Some members of the public camped outside the court for 3 days to get a seat. But when the sentence came down, it was swift. The longest sentence of 10 years was handed down to law professor Benny Tai, considered an organiser of the primary elections in 2020, which the authorities deemed to violate the national security law. Outside court, tensions were high. A large number of police watched on as family members of the convicted claimed their loved ones were the victims of political persecution.
The UK's major telecoms providers have agreed on new measures designed to protect vulnerable people when landline phones are moved to an internet-based service. Around 2 million people use wearable safety alarms which connect to a landline in order to summon help in an emergency. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, reports.
Currently, the final deadline for switching off the copper wire landline service in the UK is January 2027. The industry says the move is unavoidable as the old infrastructure is no longer fit for purpose. But concerns have been raised about the impact the change will have on vulnerable people using safety alarms. After the switchover, a power cut or internet outage could leave them without working phones, rendering their alarms useless. Under the new agreement between the government and BT, Virgin Media, Sky and Vodafone, engineers will offer to visit households and test alarms to make sure they still work after the switchover. The firms will also carry out a safeguarding checklist before any work is done in these homes.
Zoe Kleinman reporting.
Thanks very much, Lisa. It is just gone 8:10, and I'm in deepest Wiltshire this morning, in amongst the rolling fields of this lovely county. The day is clearing here. It started wet and blustery, with the windows streaked with rain. Whatever the weather, the work does not stop for farmers. I'm on the farm of Minette Batters, now Baroness Batters. You might remember the name. She's the former president of the National Farmers Union and is our host today. Earlier, she showed me round.
You're better dressed for this than I am.
Well, I've been outside all day. I'm not really well dressed, but it's just damp and horrible, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah. Tell me about the farm and what you do here.
I'm a tenant here. My father farmed here before me, but actually he was in partnership with my landlords. I'm now on what they call an FBT, a long-term FBT, and actually sort of coming up for negotiating the next round. So we have spring calving suckler cows. We've also got an autumn calving herd as well. We grow spring barley. And we've got a few sheep. And then we're quite diversified. So we've got a wedding venue, holiday cottage, and we grow British flowers as well. I always wanted to farm, and my dad was always adamant that I wasn't going to farm, and so that made me more determined to do it. Yeah. I love the challenge of it. I mean, nothing beats seeing a calf or a lamb born in the spring. I have to say, nothing is worse than seeing one die either, but it's a way of life.
Well, I'll speak to the crossbench peer, Baroness Batters, in a moment. We haven't come to Wiltshire just for the joy of being on a farm. Today sees farmers from across the country descend on London for lobbying and protest. The target of their ire, changes in the budget to the way that farms will be taxed. Before the budget, something known as agricultural property relief meant that farmers paid no inheritance tax on the farms they inherited. Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, changed that. From 2026, farms worth more than £1 million will face a 20% tax, though exemptions can bring that threshold up to £3 million. For a relatively small budget measure, it's expected to raise around £200 million. It has caused a heck of a row. Most of these political arguments and crises blow over in a week. I asked our political editor, Chris Mason, if this was different.
This does feel like it has legs as an argument, Johnny. We're nearly 3 weeks on, aren't we now, from the budget, and what might have seemed then to be something of a fiscal footnote, it has coagulated into this sustained, noisy, angry row. Now, there's a bit of context to all of this. The grumps, if you like, of farmers going back several years post-Brexit changes, terrible weather, COVID, chopping and changing of farming ministers. But what we've got now with this row about inheritance tax is something that, from the government's perspective, runs the risk of being cast into a far broader and potentially politically dangerous conversation for them around identity and belonging and understanding, an impression that an urban government is unsighted on rural mores and traditions. That said, we should emphasise that the government is pushing back and absolutely insistent that it isn't going to change, that it isn't going to mitigate away the sharp edges of this policy, and a sense from some that the farmers are a well-organised, self-serving, noisy lobby, and they need to be stood up to. And certainly from the government's perspective, they're saying that the current system isn't fair, it isn't sustainable, lots of rather rich folk have spent a fortune on land in order to avoid inheritance tax, and that when you crunch the numbers, the government insists, the numbers of farmers affected each year is actually relatively small, and it is those who are the most well-off.
Yeah, it's interesting, Chris, you mentioned that issue of identity. And here it sort of puts a Labour government on the defensive, because Labour traditionally, if not so much now, has been a rather urban political force. The claim, of course, that they just townies don't understand the countryside.
Yes, that might be a prejudice that in the past sort of cephalogical map would bear out with some evidence. In other words, the clustering of Labour support in the urban parts of the UK. Actually now, given the stonking nature of their win a few months ago, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of Labour MPs representing rural Britain. And that changes and recalibrates the nature of this argument. And certainly in terms of what we're hearing in terms of pushback from ministers is talk of what they are doing and hope to do in the coming years that will be noticed and they hope valued in rural parts of the country. And they are the familiar arguments we hear the whole time around improvement to public services, doctors, surgeries, schools, hospitals, etc. And making that point with a rural footprint, if you like, as well as a kind of pan-UK one.
Chris, to back down now would set a dreadful precedent, especially this early in a parliamentary term. But there are ways and means, aren't there? In particular, the threshold where this tax begins to bite. Do you get any smell that that's under consideration?
At the moment, I get no smell at all that there is a willingness to back down for all the reasons that we've discussed and then loaded onto that, the observation you make there, which politically it would look very weak so early on. When I speak to people in government, they are absolutely insistent they are not entertaining any mitigations and they are determined to press ahead. So, as the farmers gather this morning, the nature of the dispute and disagreement is very live and, as these stand, isn't going away.
That was Chris Mason, our political editor, just a few moments ago. I'm joined by Baroness Batters, Minette Batters. Good morning.
Good morning, Johnny.
And presumably, to get a farmer off his or her farm takes some effort. There must be a fairly impressive degree of concern to see this protest and this lobbying happening today in London.
I saw a lot of things happen in the 6 years that I was president of the NFU, but I think this is the straw that has broken the camel's back, really. It's come on the back of so many challenges in the industry, and for Labour to have just come into government and done this, having said that they most definitely would not do this. In fact, Keir Starmer, when he gave the keynote at our conference in 23, he committed to not doing this. You know, he said once a family farm goes, it cannot be brought back. We have to treat them differently. So I'm absolutely staggered and flabbergasted at what is happening. And I have to say, the rhetoric and the policy do not match this continual talk of wealthy people. You've heard time and time again, your interview with Richard, you know, these are cash poor, asset rich. Yes, if they sold the entire business, that farm, like many others, has been in the family since the 1950s. So the rhetoric and the policy are seemingly two different things. And I have to say, it looks like Treasury have mown ministers down with their own proposals because it really does not stack up.
Okay, well, I mean, the policy has not just been plucked out of nowhere. There is a method behind what the government is doing or what it says it's doing. This is what Steve Reid, the Secretary of State for the Environment, said.
I don't think it helps farmers or anybody else if wealthy individuals are able to buy up land as a means of avoiding their inheritance tax liability. But it isn't just that. We think the wealthiest landowners and the wealthiest people in the sector can afford to contribute more at that point. But I said we're going to be fair and proportionate in doing this. And under the changes that have been proposed, 73% of claimants will still pay nothing at all in inheritance tax.
I know there's argument over the figures, but it has to be said that the independent economist Paul Johnson from the Institute of Fiscal Studies said it's a very small number of farms and farmers that are actually going to be affected by this, and that, all right, there may be lots of farms out there that rise above the threshold, but when it comes to actually claiming, it's going to be a very small number. What do you make of it?
Well, the data is disputed, and don't forget that it is a combination of APR and BPR, so that makes a big difference.
The business and that, property relief, yeah.
Absolutely, so yeah. That changes this 73% figure. And this whole conversation of wealthy people buying up land, I mean, that is still going on. You know, you can sell your business using business asset rollover relief, you can buy land and offset your capital gains tax. So that hasn't changed at all. And one of the bigger worries I've had for a long time as this country has been up for sale. We have been selling off British businesses hand over fist. Morrison's, you remember, being sold. We've sold out a lot of our care homes, veterinary practices, farmland to private equity. There is nothing there on capital gains. So why punish the very people that Labour have said that they wanted to protect, often large estates, you know, have trusts in place, other mechanisms. These are the people who are caught between the lifestyle farmer that I think makes up the majority of that 73% and others who have, you know, managed their fiscal relationship with the land differently. These are the small farming businesses in the middle. Those are the ones that are caught. And at the very least, Labour must consult, you know, to have come out and done this. There is huge discrepancy between those figures. So I think they have to consult. They have to find out the facts. They only let DEFRA know, I'm told, the day before that this was published.
Victoria Atkins, the Shadow Secretary of State for the Environment, was on the programme earlier. She mentioned a couple of other things that have sort of battered farmers. That's the national insurance rise and also changes to the subsidy system. That presumably adds sort of fuel to farmers' fire.
Of course it does. And you know, when you add these taxes, you know, lifting the rate of national living wage, minimum wage, national insurance hikes, obviously they are a cost and somebody has to pick them up. The farmer is already picking up probably 50% more costs than they were back in 2019. They haven't been able to pass them on. Many people will have suffered from the rationing of salads, the rationing of eggs that we saw with the hikes in energy prices on the back of the war in Ukraine. We must have a solid approach to a plan for food production. And at the moment, it feels like the fiscal bucket just grows. The penalties just continue to grow. That will have impact on the consumer.
You spent 6 years sort of, if not locking horns, then certainly discussing things with government. It's a different government now, obviously. It's a Labour government. And that relationship between farmers and government seems to be under a lot of strain. Do you think it can be reset after this, or do you think it's ruptured?
It has to be reset. I mean, one of the challenges I found was managing to sort of stay at the table and not be chucked out of the room for bad behaviour, effectively. It's vital that we find a way through this. We are mid-transition from leaving the Common Agricultural Policy. We've had so much change. You know, the NFU Farmer Confidence Survey will show that, you know, feelings are at an all-time low. Confidence is low. So we've got to reset the relationship. We've got to have a solid plan for the future of food production. Don't forget, it was the Attlee government in 1947 on the back of two world wars and rationing that said we can never be in this position again. We must be producing more of our own food. This Labour government needs to get to grips with what Attlee was saying back then, because these are businesses. They have huge interaction with the whole of the rural economy. Over 70% of the country is a farmed landscape. This affects schools, it affects jobs, all the allied trades. So we must have a plan for the future of farming and come through this and resolve it.
Baroness Batters, Minette Batters, thank you very much.
Thank you.
23 minutes past eight. I should tell you that the rural revolt and how farmers are thinking was the subject of the latest Today podcast. Nick and I spoke at length to James Rebanks, former guest editor of this programme. His chronicles, his books about his farm in Cumbria were bestsellers. You can find that now on BBC Sounds. Just search for the Today podcast. I have to say there's been a very big response to that podcast, and his impassioned defence of farming clearly struck a chord. Bit of breaking news on a separate subject. Here at the BBC, Zoe Ball has just announced that she is going to step down as presenter of the BBC Radio 2 breakfast show. She's staying with the station but is no longer going to be the host of the Radio 2 breakfast show on weekdays, and says she's doing it to focus on her family. Let's move on at 24 minutes past eight. Two powerful new digital therapies for tics and Tourette syndrome are being recommended by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. One is called Orbit. It's accessed via a web browser. It uses videos, animation and interactive scripts to help children between 9 and 17 years old. And another is called Neupulse or Neopulse, a wearable wrist-worn device linked to mobile phones and used to treat those over the age of 12. Very exciting development in that field. Let's discuss it with Jess Tom, who's co-artistic director of Tourette's Hero, who lives with Tourette's, and Jeremy Stern, consultant neurologist specialising in Tourette's syndrome. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
Biscuit.
I should just say there's a chance of offensive language here owing to the involuntary aspect of this neurological condition. Let's see how we go, and I'll start with you, if I may, Jeremy. Dr. Stern, I should say, how significant a development is this, do you think?
Well, I think it's very significant that NICE has turned its gaze to Tourette syndrome, because they did a survey of 1,500 people and found that they were waiting from 6 months to 2 years even to get a diagnosis. So there's a problem in basic services in the NHS, and these two new technology-enabled therapies could give better access to treatment. And they're based on two very different principles. Would you like me to speak more about that now?
Yes, do. Yeah.
First one, which you mentioned, is Orbit. So this is based on treatment we know works, which is a specialized kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, which can work for children and adults. But the problem is there aren't enough specialized psychologists in the NHS to provide this, and it's not funded. So having it available online will enable more people to be treated more easily and in their own homes as well, without needing the psychologist.
And the other one, NeoPulse?
So NeoPulse is completely different. This delivers electrical pulses at the wrist, a bit like a smartwatch. These go up the nerve into the brain, and they modulate these involuntary movements that are the main problem in Tourette syndrome. And people who've tried it have found really quite a powerful effect. But we need to longer-term data to see if it will work for people over a longer period.
Right. Jess, really fascinating stuff. Important to say, these therapies aren't a cure. They won't work for everyone. But how excited are you by their approval?
It's really exciting to have any new technologies or approaches or treatment pathways for people with Tourette's. As Jeremy said, families are waiting far too long, to access diagnosis and support, and are often left with very little information about a complex condition that affects people in very individual ways. So anything that connects people to support more quickly is brilliant. And anything that gives people tools and approaches, hedgehog, that they can use within their life to manage the impact of Tourette's is powerful. It's also worth saying that access to other types of support, like support with education and access to work and social care, and joined up healthcare, throughout our lives, is also really essential. But it's great news that NICE is looking at ways to make access to support quicker and more consistent across the country, because it's really patchy as it currently stands, and lots of people are missing out and being left with very little advice and help.
And do you think, Jess, that the public understanding of Tourette's and tics has improved in recent years? Do you think, Jess, we've got better at interacting with people who've got Tourette's?
Hedgehog, I think lots of people are better at recognising Tourette's. I think the complexity of the condition and how it can impact people's lives is not necessarily brilliantly well understood. The thing I would say is that people's approaches and responses to tics can make a huge impact. So the condition itself is really unpredictable. The only predictable thing about Tourette's is that it's unpredictable. Other people's unpredictable reactions and responses really affects quality of life. And so that is something that everybody can start doing things about now, alongside approaches that help us manage our tics and use tools within our lives to do the things that matter to us.
What's your advice then for other people? You say that it's about what other people do and how they respond. How should other people respond?
Well, I say it's very personal and very individual. For me, learning about Tourette's, understanding and having the confidence to explain the condition to other people has made a powerful impact. As has practical approaches and support. Tic reduction is really useful, and that feels really exciting about potentially what these new technologies offer. I really would love, particularly children and young people, to know that reducing your tics isn't the only way to lead a happy and full life. With the right support and understanding and access to joined up, robust healthcare throughout our lives, people with Tourette's can achieve all sorts of things. These new technologies, though, and the focus of NICE on Tourette's and tic disorders feels really encouraging and really positive.
It does indeed. So, Dr. Stern, what do you think are the next steps?
Well, firstly, Jess herself has been a great advocate for people with Tourette syndrome, and completely agree with everything she was saying. So what NICE have said is they've endorsed these treatments for use for further study in the NHS over the next 3 years, because we really need more data about whether they work in the long term And also how they affect quality of life. Because as Jess said, it's not just about ticks. And all that's been mainly measured in these studies was the ticks. So we really need more data, but they are definitely promising treatments that could help in future.
Dr. Jeremy Stern, consultant neurologist specialising in Tourette syndrome, and Jess Tom, co-artistic director of Tourette's Hero. Thank you both very much indeed.
It's just gone 8:30. Here's Cathy with the sports news.
Morning. A few football headlines. To start, Scotland avoided relegation and instead will have a Nations League playoff in March to decide their status in the competition after a 2-1 win over Poland, thanks to a stoppage time header from the Scotland captain Andy Robertson. Northern Ireland are promoted to League B. They had a 2-2 draw with Luxembourg. Wales host Iceland tonight and need to win that match to secure their return to the top tier of the Nations League, but they do need other results to go their way. Now, at the start of this year, the professional triathletes organisation and World Triathlon agreed to combine in an 8-race T100 World Triathlon Tour. That's a 2-kilometre swim, 80-kilometre bike ride and an 18-kilometre run. The final event took place at the weekend in Dubai. And I've been speaking to the PTO's chairman, Chris Kermode, about the work that goes into the funding and investment of sports that are trying to become more mainstream.
The major attraction for me was the audience numbers. If you break them down individually, the three disciplines, running, cycling and swimming, if you actually combined those audiences, it's about 1 billion people. Triathlon has been an unbelievably uncommercialized sport for many, many years, and the rise in interest and participation is incredible. Triathletes are probably one of the most valuable audiences in sport. People call it the new golf. And yeah, we just want to sort of consolidate and then commercialize the sport.
For that kind of commercialization and transition, presumably you need committed investors. What are the types of brands that would work with triathlon?
We have, obviously, our founding investor was Sir Michael Moritz, who was, I've just literally flown back at Heathrow Airport, flown back from Dubai, where we had our world championships. And Sir Michael came, we had business seminars, and we're raising next round of funding, which the interest has been phenomenal. I mean, what's strange is I was walking around in Dubai, and you know, T100 was not around 9 months ago. We are a new brand, and people are talking about it as if it's been around for 25 years. So what we've done in a year has been remarkable.
You were president of the ATP, the men's tennis tour. What did you learn from that mainstream sport that has perhaps helped with getting investment and innovation into this new T100 triathlon world tour?
Absolutely. I mean, years of being in the tennis, obviously with various, often talked about too many stakeholders in the game. And so, you know, we've been in a lucky position when I actually, when Sir Michael asked me to be in charge of PTO, as it was then, he said, what would you do? I said, rebrand and have a season-long narrative and all that sort of stuff. And the main thing for me was, we can't do this by committee. So I said, we can move very quickly and be much more innovative and commercial by not having those layers and layers of structure. So I've simplified it all, and it's been hugely successful so far.
Well, you are coming to the end of the first year. You've just had the Dubai tournament, as you mentioned. How important, though, is it to have top triathletes buying into the idea? Alex Yee, the Paris Olympic gold medalist, doesn't compete in it. Do you need athletes like him involved in order to build this brand?
Personally, I think any sport has to be bigger than any athlete. I mean, that's just goes without saying. Now, if you get the superstar in, so, you know, golf with a Tiger Woods, tennis with Roger Federer, and you mentioned Alex Yee in triathlon, obviously that's the gold dust. But if the foundations and infrastructure aren't there for it to be successful without that, then you're sort of on a road to failure. So with triathlon, there's historically been two distances. So you've had the short course, which is the Olympic course, which Alex Yee competed in, and then Ironman, which is an extremely long 9-10 hour product. And so when we designed the T100 being 100 kilometers, we're hoping to attract the athletes from both the long distance Ironman and then the Olympic distance coming up. So I think the athletes wanted to see what we were doing, see how it would work, and also that we're going to be around for a long time, which we clearly are, because as I said, we're about to complete this next round of investment, and the media coverage has been incredible. So yeah, I believe those athletes will be running very soon.
It's an interesting concept. Chris Kermode, thank you very much for talking to me this morning.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Well, Chris Kermode mentioned superstars in tennis there, and the 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal will retire from that sport this week after representing Spain in the Davis Cup in Malaga. Spain played the Netherlands in the quarterfinals, but they haven't confirmed if the 38-year-old will play today. And in the women's team event, the Billie Jean King Cup, Great Britain faced Slovakia in the semi-finals. They're attempting to reach the final for the first time since 1981. You can watch the semi-final on the BBC iPlayer and app from 11 o'clock this morning.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. After the news at 9 o'clock this morning, it's The Long View with Jonathan Freeland.
The rains fall and fall, causing devastating floods that bring death and destruction. The blame game soon starts, with survivors pointing the finger at politicians and their failure to prepare, to warn, to act. That's the story in Valencia, struck by disaster just a few weeks ago. But it was also the fate of Wuhan and Nanjing when China was hit by perhaps the most lethal floods in history nearly a century ago. So join me for the long view of natural disasters and their political impact in half an hour and on BBC Sounds.
It's 24 minutes to nine. Quick look at the weather today. Rain and hill snow for most areas. Blustery snow showers will continue in the far north, and it will be cold.
Is it snowing where you are, Johnny?
It is not snowing here. The rain has stopped. It is clearing slightly, and it's not even that cold, actually. It's quite nice.
God, sounds perfect, which is always the place to be. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Johnny Diamond in a non-snowing Wiltshire and Amal Rajan in a sort of snowy London. Here's a summary of the news at 24 minutes to nine with Lisa Costello.
The president of the National Farmers Union has called government plans to impose inheritance tax on properties worth more than £1 million an extraordinary betrayal. A group of NFU members are heading to Westminster today to urge the Chancellor to scrap the policy. A separate rally of farmers will take place near Downing Street later in the day. A group of the biggest retailers in the UK is warning that price rises and job cuts will be inevitable because of the tax increases in the budget and other government policies. The British Retail Consortium said they could have to absorb an extra £7 billion of costs. Snow is falling over large areas of the UK. It's forced the closure of more than 100 schools in the Powys, Wrexham and Flintshire areas of Wales. Warnings are in place for roads in the northwest and northeast of England, and travellers are being warned of delays to rail services. And Zoe Ball has announced that she's stepping down as presenter of the Radio 2 weekday breakfast show. She'll leave the show next month after 6 years.
Lisa, thank you. Yeah, we'll have more on that Zoe Ball news with Mark Savage, our music correspondent, in about 5 or 6 minutes. But let's turn to India now, because there are extraordinary events and scenes in the Indian capital. In fact, right across much of northern India and neighbouring Pakistan. The smog in Delhi has surged to 60 times the World Health Organization's recommended daily maximum. And India's Supreme Court has criticised the authorities in Delhi for the delay in enforcing restrictions to limit that worsening air pollution. Since Monday, all diesel trucks, except those carrying essential items, have been banned from entering the city. This is India's capital, remember. Most school classes have been moved online. Those with respiratory diseases have been warned they should stay at home. And the same pollution, caused primarily by farmers burning straw at the end of rice harvests, have plagued neighbouring Pakistan for weeks too. Let's speak to Bhargav Krishna, who's fellow at India's Centre for Policy Research and joins us now. Bhargav, good morning from London.
Good morning, Amal. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Appreciate your time. A difficult time for people in Delhi and across much of northern India. Just what is driving this air pollution? Why is air pollution so bad in Delhi just now?
So it's not that air pollution in Delhi is fine for the rest of the year and it just gets bad during this particular time of the year. It's that air pollution in Delhi is quite poor throughout the rest of the year, and it's worsened during winters, particularly because of the way the weather works in this region. What we end up having during this time of the year, especially in late November, early December, and through to about early February, is you have something called an inversion, which traps air pollution and stops it from dispersing as it would naturally otherwise. Couple that with seasonal sources like crop residue burning, as well as people using wood and other means of heating to keep themselves warm, and you end up with this cocktail of smoke that blankets the entire region.
And what can be done to clear this smog?
there are things that we can control and things that we can't control, right? We can't really control the weather in any meaningful way, but what we can do is control the sources of pollution that we know contribute to air pollution, not just during the winter, but throughout the rest of the year as well. So vehicular emissions, especially from trucks and cars, are a big contributor to Delhi air pollution throughout the year. Various other industrial sources, power generation from thermal power plants, all of these are complex sources for which we already have answers on how to regulate, and we don't do a good enough job of that throughout the rest of the year. And compounding air pollution from other sources adds to it in winter, causing this problem.
And all of this, the solutions have been somewhat stuck in politics because of the very particular way in which Delhi is run as against the rest of the country.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's just a Delhi issue, though. It is yes. a whole of North India issue, in the sense that if you look at anywhere within the Indo-Gangetic plain, as you mentioned, from Punjab in Pakistan all the way to West Bengal in the eastern part of India, this is the same story that you see. It is a governance challenge in the sense that air pollution is diffuse. It's not any one sector's responsibility. You have four or five different sources that contribute to it at any one point of time, which means you need to have coordinated action across sectors. And that becomes challenging in a democratic structure.
Mr. Krishna, Bhargav Krishna from the Centre for Policy Research in India, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 19 minutes to nine and we are going from smog to snow because here in the UK, motorists and commuters are facing disruption across parts of the country with that first taste of winter. National Rail said the weather could have an impact on Northern Rail services in Yorkshire this morning. National Highways has issued an amber severe weather alert for snow on roads in the northeast and the northwest regions of England, and schools have been closed in Wales and in Lincolnshire. Ollie Constable is our correspondent following the wind and the snow. He's on the border of Derbyshire and Yorkshire. Ollie, you've got snow there and snow elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Owler Bar on the edge of the Peak District. We came here because we were told that this is where we'd expect to see lots of snow. That higher ground expected to see up to 200 millimetres of snow falling as part of that yellow weather warning for snow and ice. It's a very picturesque scene. You won't believe it. It's a beautiful view over the Peak District, and the roads are fairly clear as well.
Snow is a divisive issue, isn't it, Ollie? Because there's a lot of people who love it and love the look of it, even the feel of it and playing in it. But for people trying to get round the country, it is a problem. And we are starting to see transport disruption or concerns over that.
Absolutely. I didn't love it at 4 o'clock this morning when I was walking from my house to meet the crew because of the amount of snow that we'd had overnight in North Derbyshire. A lot of those side roads were very badly affected. Those untreated roads, that's what it is, isn't it? When they haven't had the snow ploughs and the gritters, then they are going to be a bit more difficult to navigate. But certainly the main roads are a lot better. We have seen pictures from the motorways where things are running pretty well, actually, across the country, even with some of that fresh snow falling. Here in the Peak District, we've had lots of Derbyshire County Council gritters going past us as well, keeping that salt going down. So they're doing their bit to keep people moving.
Ollie, thanks very much indeed. And as I should just add, 100 schools closed in Wales, 2 shut in Lincolnshire so far.
17 minutes to 9, shortly after 8 o'clock this morning, so about half an hour ago, Zoe Ball had this announcement for her listeners on Radio 2.
OK, you lovely bunch, I have some news. After 6 years of fun times alongside you all on The Breakfast Show, I've decided it's time to step away from the early alarm call and start a new chapter.
So Zoe Ball has revealed she'll be leaving her breakfast show on Radio 2 on December the 20th. To focus on her family, she says she's going to stay on Radio 2 in some form. Let's speak to Mark Savage, our BBC music correspondent. Big news in the world of radio, Mark, because Radio 2's breakfast show is the biggest show on the biggest network.
That's absolutely right. 6.3 million listeners to Zoe Ball every day. And because of that, she's one of the BBC's highest paid presenters, earning about £950,000 last year. And that show is a remarkably warm way to start the day. She brings a kind of cheery coziness to the airwaves. And I think a lot of listeners are going to miss her very much. But they have just in the last couple of minutes announced that Scott Mills, her fellow Radio 2 DJ, will take over the show in the new year, with Trevor Nelson taking over Scott's show, which is currently in the afternoons.
And it's worth saying, Mark, I know you pay attention to these figures in detail. For all the noise, for all the talk about podcasts, still the vast majority of audio listening in this country is to live radio. And within the live radio universe, or within Britain at least, radio still is the big beast, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. I mean, podcasts, I don't think there are any podcasts in the UK that get more than 1 million daily listeners. Radio 2 has a weekly audience of 13 million. And even on the Today programme, you've got 5.8 million people listening every morning. So that is the principal way that people get access to news, to music, to all of the benefits that radio brings. Zoe Ball, of course, is a very seasoned broadcaster. She started off in children's television in the 1990s on shows like Live and Kicking and Play Days. She was a regular presenter on Big Breakfast and Top of the Pops and became the first female breakfast host, not just on Radio 2, but on Radio 1, where she was the breakfast DJ from 1997 to 2000.
Yeah, she's an absolute giant. And as she says, it's going to be staying on Radio 2 in some form. Mark Savage, our music correspondent, thanks very much indeed.
Stepping away from the early alarm call, why would she want to do that?
Now, not as early as ours, Johnny.
It's certainly crispy. New Zealand has seen some of its biggest protests in years after at least 40,000 people turned out for a rally in Wellington over a controversial bill that threatens to overhaul the Treaty of Waitangi. That's the country's founding document drawn up in 1840 between the Maori people and the British colonisers. The bill has divided a country often seen as a leader for indigenous rights. Our New Zealand correspondent Katie Watson now reports from Wellington.
Thousands of people are marching towards Parliament. This is the end of a nine-day hikoi, or peaceful march, which started in the northernmost tip of the North Island of New Zealand, and they've been making their way down to the capital. Many people are dressed in black, white and red, the colours of the Maori community, and they're talking about unity and love and honouring the Maori people here in New Zealand.
Arriving at the Beehive, New Zealand's Parliament building, the message was loud and clear. Mess with the Treaty of Waitangi and you're messing with the rights of the Maori people, say the demonstrators, the first inhabitants of this land they call Aotearoa. The crowds kept coming. Throughout the day, spontaneous hakas broke out. Maori war cries rallying supporters to do battle with a government they say is undermining them.
We're safer together, really. That's what gives Parliament its right to operate. You know, it's that manaakitanga, come, haramai, you're welcome here, you do you, we do us. All together we'll thrive, but when the scales sort of get tipped out, everybody's in danger, not just Maori.
Just wanted to come in solidarity and support it because it doesn't actually just feel like a Maori issue, it feels like a Aotearoa issue, really, for everyone who lives here.
Let's not forget about all the people who aren't making a noise, who aren't trying to undermine Parliament.
For David Seymour, who's introduced this plan, those protesting don't represent most New Zealanders. He says it's about treating everyone here as equals, rather than giving special treatment to Māori.
What my treaty principles bill says that I, like everybody else, whether their ancestors came here 1,000 years ago, like some of mine did, or just got off the plane at Auckland International Airport this morning to begin their journey as New Zealanders, have the same basic rights and dignity as human beings. Culture, language, all flows out of that foundation of equal rights.
It's a view that does have support in wider New Zealand.
I don't really know what the Māori are arguing about. I think we're all one person, we're all New Zealanders, so you know, they seem to want more and more and more, and we just have to all work together.
Well, I think all New Zealanders should be equal. We've got people from all many different countries of the world living in this country, and we're pretty good too. It's a pretty good country to live in.
But experts in Māori law dispute this way of thinking. Dr. Carlin Jones is from Victoria University in Wellington.
The Treaty of Waitangi is an agreement between Māori communities and government, and so it sets up that particular relationship. But it also provides a really useful model for thinking about ways of accommodating difference and diversity, ways of drawing on having different voices involved in decision making. And those are models which aren't just applicable to Māori, but can be expanded to all kinds of other different communities of interest in Aotearoa. And I think if you're unwilling to take that step of engaging with Māori, then I think it's very unlikely that as a government you'd be willing to engage or think about how to accommodate difference in other kinds of circumstances.
The strength of emotion was clear last week when this happened. A Māori MP taking a stand in a traditional way. That led to the suspension of Parliament and began a broader conversation about minority rights. Debbie Narewa Paka is the co-leader of Te Pāti Māori, the Māori Party.
To see it in our, you know, in Parliament, in the highest house of political being in Aotearoa, there's been a real state of surprise. And I think real expression of disappointment and sadness that in 2024, when we see politics in the Trump extremes, that this is what Māori are having to endure.
The bill's unlikely to pass. Even the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, who's part of the same coalition government, says it's divisive. But that's not the point, say protesters. The fact politicians are even questioning Māori's position in society is damaging enough.
Katie Watson reporting there from Wellington. Coming up later this morning, James Gallagher and his guests demystify health issues and try to bring clarity to conflicting advice. Today they'll be exploring child tooth decay, and he's joined by Professor Zoe Marshman, a professor in dental public health at the University of Sheffield. That's Inside Health this morning at 9:30, and more through the day on the live stream on BBC Sounds on the farmers' rally on the inheritance tax plans for farms worth over £1 million. The government, of course, pointing to exemptions, which it says means the tax will hit relatively few farms which are worth more than that.
9 minutes to nine, and a big interview to finish the programme today, because Toto Wolff is one of the biggest figures in global sport, and specifically motor racing. A former driver himself, he is the CEO, co-owner and team principal at the Mercedes Formula One team, where he oversaw much of the glory achieved by Lewis Hamilton. Formula One was a huge global multi-billion dollar business even before the Netflix series Drive to Survive achieved a huge global audience when it was granted intimate access to the pit lane.
I love the danger, that adrenaline and that excitement.
They have crashed! They've gone into each other!
I'm not worried about dying.
Sounds good. Well, Toto Wolff has now given the writer Matt Wyman unprecedented access to his inner sanctum, and the result is a book called Inside Mercedes F1, Life in the Fast Lane. And Toto Wolff joins us now from Monaco. Toto, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Just tell us, what was your motivation with this book? Why did you want to give Matt Wyman such access to your inner world?
By the way, you caught me literally on the way to the UK. So I'm looking forward to be there today.
Oh, fantastic.
I felt we had requests about doing a book for a long time, and it didn't feel right to talk about personalities, either myself or the drivers, because it's not the end of the journey. And I feel one day when you say, that was it for me, you can then write a book and say, this sums it up. But this book is something special. It's a book that shows the ins and outs of how a Formula One team operates. It is not about one person. It is about the many jobs that exist in the team. And I feel it's giving quite a good perspective of what it is all about and how vast and complex the organization is.
Well, forgive me, but I looked at the book in some detail. I think it gives us the ins and outs of Toto Wolff as well, which is very interesting. And, you know, the Netflix series is called Drive to Survive. And I just wonder, reading the book, if there is something of that philosophy in your own life, because the book does detail how your own childhood drove your ambition, and specifically the fact that your dear father was diagnosed with a brain tumor when you were just a little boy. How did that affect you?
I mean, each of us will have their own story, and obviously it's always a subjective feeling. There is things that are very dramatic out there in the world that you can justify or that you can call trauma. So I don't want to necessarily put the spotlight on me and say this is what happened to me, but let's say in my own subjective perception, it was pretty bad because my father was ill since I can remember, being a small child, and suffered from brain cancer for over 10 years, and we went through the, let's say, emotional hardship. I had to look after my younger sister, and also financial hardship. So I was raised in an environment where there wasn't a lot of money around, and that certainly played a role, a massive driver in my future professional and private life.
Yeah, I mean, you're being very humble about it, and I can see that you don't want to say that, you know, that you've had an unusually difficult childhood, but it's worth people knowing that your father's business collapsed. I think you were marched out of your classroom because your parents couldn't afford the fees. Do you, as you now look back, having achieved considerable success in business as well as sport, do you think that that childhood experience was part of what fired your ambition?
Yes, definitely, because the moment you just described was very humiliating. You know, it was in the afternoon in class that we were called to the headmaster. I found my younger sister there, and he basically told us that school fees are not paid, and grab your bags from the classroom and then take the tram home. And explaining to a 10-year-old sister what was actually happening was pretty bad, but there was no fault of my father nor my mother, who tried to survive for us. But I remember from that day, I didn't want to be dependent from an adult anymore. I wanted to be grown up myself and looking after my sister and looking after the family. And I think that kind of triggered how can I say, this will to succeed and be independent from anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that will obviously fascinate UK readers is that the book does go deep on your relationship with Lewis Hamilton, and it touches on the moment that he tells you he's leaving Mercedes for Ferrari, a move he's making next year. Did you see that coming?
First of all, you know, the UK has played such an important role for me in the last 15 years when I joined Williams in 2009, and I've been living there for a long time. But then obviously coming back to Lewis, he has been one of the key people in my professional and personal life in the last 12 years. We joined the team together. At the same time, we didn't really know what to expect from each other, and we went through a tremendous spell of success, but also difficult times, like in any relationship. And I kind of heard the noises that there was this possibility that he was leaving. But we met in my house in Oxford, and he basically said, you know, this is a step I feel is good for all of us. It's good for me to reinvent myself. Every driver wants to be in Ferrari, and good for the Mercedes team too, because we've been with each other for 12 years. So maybe we are kind of reinvigorating ourselves. And that's when he told me. And initially, obviously, it was a bit of a surprise because it was at the beginning of the season, which is highly unusual. But also, I think where he came from was a sense of fairness to say, listen, I'm going to tell you very early. It may be awkward during the season, but so you can position the team and yourself for the years to come.
And it's interesting. I know you speak to your friend Pep Guardiola, the Manchester City boss, about issues like this, about managing icons. And I know you feel that in Formula One, cognitive sharpness is absolutely vital. So was there a kind of pragmatic part of you that thought, actually, look, frankly, every driver's got a shelf life, even the great Lewis Hamilton, there's a time for him to move on?
You know how that was taken a little bit out of context. What I was referring to is that all of us, we age, and whether it is being in the car or on a pitch, or as a manager, an entrepreneur, and you have to, and this is what I'm trying to do with myself, understand, am I going from great to good? Because good is not in Formula One anymore. Now, contrary to my own self-assessment, I think we see with Lewis that he's very much there when the car is right, and we haven't been able to give him that car for him to perform best. And that is a frustration that we equally have in the team and for himself. But he's very sharp. He's different to when he was a 20-year-old. That's certainly clear. But his experience and his racecraft is tremendous.
Final thought. People never really know someone from their public profile. You've got this reputation as a tough, demanding, successful leader. What has made you effective in Formula One?
Well, effective at times, not so effective as others, but this is how, you know, Our business is a cyclical business also, and you have to acknowledge that. I think most important is trying to stay authentic. You know, we are who we are. The moment we're trying to play something or somebody else that, you know, people realize subconsciously or consciously. So I'm trying to just be myself with all the good and bad character traits.
Okay, very, very brief final thought. You've worked with some of the greats in your field, including Lewis Hamilton. What separates the greats from the merely very good?
Well, it's a combination of the right genetics, its nature, its nurture, having had the possibilities and opportunities to grow up, but also high intelligence and high social intelligence. Maneuvering that field is not only driving the car, but also knowing to...